it up, take what's there, cause finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. This week in Radical History for the week starting January 19th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and more radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website.
Yo, check this out, man. There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This week in Radical History for January 19th, 1808, anarchist Lysander Spooner lives. Spooner set up a private postal service so successful that the federal government decided to outlaw it. Author of No Treason, The Constitution of No Authority, arguing the Constitution and the basic assumption of government is binding to no one. This book was described as possibly the most subversive document ever printed in this nation.
The city of Taos, New Mexico was awash with blood on this day in 1847. Just a year after being vacated by the Spanish and transferred to U.S. control, some of the Native Americans in the area were allied with the Mexican population there and had fought alongside them against the Spanish. To them, the land in question was both their ancestral home and part of Mexico. And so on this day, a group of Native Americans and Mexican nationals confronted the newly appointed governor of New Mexico, Charles Bent. An altercation erupted and Bent was killed, as were several of the Native Americans, who then went on a rampage targeting any white settlers they found. The conflict, which lasted for over a month and which took some 1,500 federal troops to suppress, was known as the Taos Uprising.
Also on January 19th, 1892 in Cuba, anarchists celebrate the first Cuban Regional Congress. The anarchists recommended the Cuban working class join the ranks of revolutionary socialism and take the path of independence. In a manifesto, they present a phrase which has passed into history. Quote, "It would be absurd for one who inspires individual freedom to oppose the collective freedom of the people." Spanish authorities would then suppress the Congress, close down the anarchist press, declare the alliance illegal, and deport or imprison the best-known anarchist participants. Also on January 19, 1915, world-famous labor organizer and songwriter Joe Hill is arrested in Salt Lake City, Utah. Joe Hill is convicted on trumped-up murder charges. His last words to his comrades was, "Don't mourn. Organize."
The U.S. Geological Survey reported on this day in 1920 that the United States' yet-to-be-extracted oil reserves would only be sufficient to meet the country's demands at the levels of that day for the next 20 years. The sizes of the known U.S. oil fields and the difficulty of extracting the oil using the methods that were current at that time informed the survey's findings, and the agency warned that the U.S. would soon become dependent on oil from other countries if it did not develop alternative forms of energy generation. The agency's warning was correct, and although new oil fields had been discovered and extraction technologies have improved, the U.S. currently imports more than 60% of the oil it consumes and uses 26% of the world's energy output while having only 5% of the world's population and only 3% of the world's remaining oil reserves. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Devin Davis.
People, the time's come.
This is your radio reporter, Crystal Graham. On this day, January 20th, in 1887, the Navy, with assistance from the U.S. Senate, leased Pearl Harbor in Hawaii as a naval base. Hawaii was still an independent kingdom and was just forced to adapt the Bayonet Constitution, a measure that stripped the king's powers and gave voting rights to Americans and European immigrants. Leasing Pearl Harbor secured American interests on the Hawaiian Islands and American dominance in the Pacific. In the 10 years that followed, the U.S. government overthrew the Hawaiian government, expanding Pearl Harbor into a state-of-the-art naval reservation and increased the military force in other island nations, such as Cuba and the Philippines. Ah, U.S. imperialism at its finest.
Say it.
This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
Also on January 20th, 1902, Army Brigadier General Jacob Smith asked the Marine Corps to assist them to help subdue the Filipino population on the island of Samar. Major Weller and his Marine Battalion were given the assignment. After a bunch of atrocities, Major Weller would be brought up on war criminal charges. Even though General Smith reported that, Weller said the following, quote, "I want no prisoners. I wish you to kill and burn. The more you kill and burn, the better it will please me. I want all prisoners killed who are capable of bearing arms in actual hostilities against the United States." Unquote. anyone up to 10 years old. The Marines executed his orders. Despite the general's testimony, Major Weller would be acquitted of all charges and eventually retire as United States Marine Corps general himself. Also on January 20, 1929 in Manchuria, the Korean anarchist guerrilla general Kim Zhao-jin is assassinated while doing some repair work on a rice mill. The Korean Anarchist Federation in China was formed in April of 1924. Over 2 million Koreans were living in Manchuria, and the Korean anarchists were very active and influential among them. We are everywhere. Also on this date in 1960 in the Belgian Congo, Patrice Lumumba, first democratically elected president, is sentenced to 6 months on trumped-up charges, and the CIA has him murdered in 1961 by order of President Ike Eisenhower himself. He is shot, transported in a CIA car, and then his body is dumped in an acid bath. Also on this date in 1981, minutes after the inauguration of acting President Reagan, 52 Americans held captive in Iran for 444 days are released following an agreement in which the United States agrees to return $8 billion in frozen assets to Iran. Later it was revealed that the release was delayed until the inauguration in a PR ploy orchestrated by the Reagan handlers to make him look good. What a hero. Also on January 20, 1996 in Palestine, Yasser Arafat wins 88% of the vote in the first Palestinian elections. Israel and the United States under Bush campaigns of, quote, democracy, unquote, do everything in its power, short of assassination, to topple him, including Israel's support of Hamas. Last year, Hamas wins the Palestinian elections, and Israel and the United States under Bush Jr. do everything they can to topple Hamas. To this date, Israel is in violation of more UN resolution regarding Palestinians than any other country's violations, almost three times as many Israeli violations than the excuse that was used to invade Iraq. And the beat and the beatings and the killings go on.
And on this day in 2001 and 2005, inauguration ceremonies were held in Washington, D.C., acknowledging George Bush in the role of American president. In 2001, the true winner of the previous year's presidential election had yet to be determined, when after an embarrassingly close race in which Bush's Democratic challenger Al Gore declined to differentiate his platform from Bush's, the vote tally in Florida remained too close to call and was widely disputed. Gore was then later shown to have won Florida's popular vote, but that evidence was suppressed when the U.S. Supreme Court halted the recount in that state. Gore conceded prematurely in 2001, but not as hastily as Bush's 2004 challenger, John Kerry. There, in another embarrassingly close race, evidence of electoral fraud in Ohio suggested the election results there may have been fictitiously skewed in Bush's favor. Kerry, however, conceded the day after the votes were cast.
Ah, as Stalin once said, those who cast the vote decide nothing. Those who count the votes decide everything. This week in Radical History for January 21st, 1801, a mysterious fire sweeps the offices of the Department of Treasury, destroying books and papers. After Republicans demand proof that the expenditures of Timothy Pickering, a recently replaced Federal Secretary of War, could be properly accounted for. Also on January 21st in 1920, the Palmer Red Raids begin, targeting labor activists and radicals from the United States government repression. Attorney General Palmer orders the roundup of all suspected and are prosecuted and deported where possible. Thousands of people were arrested nationwide sweep. Most arrests are illegal, without warrants or justification. Also on this date in 1968, four thermonuclear bombs lost when a B-52 crashes in North Star Bay, Greenland. There are reports of over 200 nuclear bombs lost over the years, and those are the ones that we know of. Also on this date in 1977, President Jimmy Carter issues unconditional pardons to most Vietnam draft resistors on his first full day in office. This pardon affects between 100,000 and 500,000 people. Wouldn't it be very nice if Obama pardons the roughly 2,000 Iraq veteran war resistors now living underground in Canada? I ain't gonna hold my breath. This week in Radical History for January 22, 1903 in Panama, U.S. gets a 99-year lease and sovereignty over the Panama Canal after engineering a coup in favor of U.S. takeover.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
Also on January 22, 1905 in Russia, Bloody Sunday, a massacre of demonstrators in St. Petersburg. Troops open fire on 100,000 workers, women and children. Over 1,000 be killed, and it is the beginning of the first Russian Revolution. Tomorrow the anarchists form part of the first Soviet, created to assist victims of the repression. This year sees a widespread of anarchist movement, which later will be suppressed by the Bolsheviks.
You keep saying you got something for me. been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin'. And now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
On January 22nd, 1966, Frank Sinatra's daughter, Nancy, releases her biggest hit, These Boots Are Made for Walkin'. 14 weeks on the chart, it goes to number one for 1 week next month. Years later, the Federals will blast it over and over and over again for the Wackos at Waco.
You keep saying when you ought to be a-changing. Now what's right is right, but you ain't been right yet. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Are you ready, boots? Start walking.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, January 22nd, in 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court delivered its famous ruling on Roe v. Wade by determining that state laws banning abortion were in violation of an individual's constitutional right to privacy. The court's decision served to legalize abortion as a woman's fundamental right and personal choice. There was a huge pro-life backlash directly following Roe v. Wade as religious right-wing fanatics increased their efforts to terrorize pro-abortion health clinics and the women who were seen entering them. You know, it's kind of ironic when you consider all the health clinics that were bombed. The pro-lifers killing people and all? Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Lastly, for January 22nd, 1991 in El Salvador, 15 villagers massacred by U.S.-supported government troops.
And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest. What may be difficult to accept is that there's nothing new about that. In fact, it's what we hire our Secretary of State and our Foreign Service to do for us. The myth is that since the First World War, we were ever able to conduct our foreign policy any other way. The United States is a superpower with enormous and divergent interests that it is committed to protect. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality. I'm Ted Koppel in New York.
This week in Radical History for January 23rd, 1870, the Baker's Massacre. The military, headed by Baker, receives a scouting report that a group of Indians led by Mountain Chief has camped along a river. They attack the site at Willow Rounds, but Mountain Chief had been warned and left the area. So Baker's men instead ended up attacking a camp of Chief Heavy Runner, who had enjoyed friendly relations with the white men. Although Baker's scouts had reportedly warned him that he was about to attack the wrong camp, he proceeded anyway against the protest of those scouts. As the men of the camp were mostly out hunting, the raid was a massacre of mostly women and children. This crime would be left out of the papers, and Baker would retire with distinction. Lastly, on January 23, 1942, in Poland, Jewish ghettos in Warsaw rise to resist the fascists. Statistically, during World War II, the Jews who resisted lived on an average longer than those who did not. Yet they wonder why the people of Gaza resist. This has been This Week in Radical History, produced from the mobile fortress of Glee Glee Studios. Special thanks again this week to both Radio Roots crew from WBAI in New York and the Neighborhood Network of Columbus, Ohio, whose audio I borrowed for the show. This week being the last week of our beloved dictator GW, I leave you now with a little ditty about just one of the many atrocities he has done in our name. Note that this last little piece, both Bush and Charles Manson speak. Now play this game with me and try to discern whose voice is saying what. Thanks for listening this week in Radical History, and as always and forever, I'm yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
Choice is an illusion created between those with power and those without.
What do all men with power want? More power.
Now they knew who was master and leader. Sheep, thought I.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Remorse for what? You people have done everything in the world to me. Doesn't that give me equal right? I can do anything I want to you people at any time I want to, because that's what you've done to me. If you spit in my face and smack me in the mouth and throw me a solid check and bind me for nothing, what do you think's going to happen when I get out of here? Well, I haven't done enough. I might be ashamed of that for not doing enough. Should have killed 400 people, then I would have felt better. Then I felt like I really offered society something. You've got it stuck in your brain that I murdered somebody. Anyone call me a murderer? I don't dare. I don't pretend to go down and do anything fancy. I can, but I find more real in the world that I'm in than I do tinsel. And the real world is the one I have to deal with every day. Believe me, if I started murdering people, there could not be left.
Chemical weapons threat. Terrorists, dangerous, die.
There are some who feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on.
As of Monday, January 19, 2009, 4,248 United States military personnel have died in Iraq since the start of the invasion.
Over 40,000 have been wounded, many sustaining major life-changing injuries such as amputations.
Join us or die.
According to the British medical journal Lancet, over 100,000 Iraqi civilians had died since the start of the invasion.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator. Just so long as I'm the dictator. Just so long as I'm the dictator. I'm the dictator. I'm the dictator. I'm the dictator. Dictator. Dictator.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي فوزا قزح طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media, which is why it is so important that we broadcast that voice each and every week. Israel continues to be obsessed by the success of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Israel is trying to legislate against it at both the state and federal level, and is now attempting to prevent its proponents from entering Israel, which includes the Palestinian territories. The following account is from Mondo Weiss. The Israeli government has published its BDS blacklist, which would prevent entry to Israel, known for months to be in the works. It includes 20 organizations that support the Palestinian-led nonviolent boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS, resistance movement against the occupation, including U.S.-based organizations American Muslims for Palestine, Code Pink, the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, and Jewish Voice for Peace. Strategic Affairs Minister Gilad Erdan, who played a critical role in compiling the blacklist, touted it as a strategic change in the way Israel handles BDS. We have shifted from defense to offense, Erdogan said. The boycott organizations need to know that the state of Israel will act against them and not allow them to enter its territory to harm its citizens. The other blacklisted U.S. organizations are National Students for Justice in Palestine and the American Friends Service Committee, as well as 11 European organizations and three more based in South Africa and South America. Leaders and members of the blacklisted organizations view it as an official implementation of Israel's long-followed unofficial policy of turning away Palestinian human rights activists at its border. Omar Barghouti, a founder of the BDS movement, said in a press release that Israel's new McCarthyism is reaching a new low. By waging an all-out war on the peaceful BDS movement for Palestine rights, and by now banning international human rights organizations and advocates from entry, Israel's desperate and brutal attempts to weaken support for BDS are already backfiring. In an interview with Plus 972 magazine, Jewish Voice for Peace Executive Director Rebecca Vilcomerson noted that Israel's decision to specifically ban JVP leaders from entry is disconcerting but not surprising, given the consistent erosion of democratic norms as well as increasing fear of the BDS movement in Israel. To Vilcomerson, the blacklist is not only an organizational hardship, but a personal one. The Brooklyn activist is married to an Israeli and has extensive family and friends in Israel and the West Bank, whom she will likely no longer be able to visit. But the barring of Jewish Voice for Peace, an explicitly Jewish organization, suggests a true ideological contradiction forming between Israel's claim as a homeland for all Jews and Israel's fear of the catalyzing BDS movement. And it further reveals the fissures within the mainstream American Jewish communities regarding Israel. Among the 20 blacklisted organizations, there was an overwhelming sense of momentum, an affirmation that BDS is successfully putting pressure on Israel to end its abuse of Palestinians. This blacklist is a declaration of failure and defeat by the State of Israel as it grows out of the global BDS movement, Dr. Osama Abu Irshad, National Policy Director at American Muslims for Palestine, told Mondawise. Israel failed in confronting this movement, which is a non-violent movement for Palestinian rights, and the only way for Israel to deal with this is to repress the activists who are fighting for Palestinian rights in a non-violent way, as it represses the Palestinians in a violent way, within the borders of occupied Palestine, Abu Irshad added. It is unclear exactly how or if the ban will inhibit the work of the blacklisted organizations, many of which already work primarily inside the United States. But Ariel Gold of Code Pink noted that the BDS blacklist could have the effect of keeping those of us that work really hard for Palestinian rights as disconnected as possible to the people struggling on the ground. The blacklist would almost certainly prevent Gold and other members of Code Pink, an organization particularly active in protests alongside Palestinians in places such as Nabi Saleh or Hebron in the occupied West Bank, from entry into Israel. It will keep us from being able to see with our own eyes and keep us from being able to participate with our own bodies, Gold told Mondawise. But Gol recognized the absurdity and desperation in this move and is confident many others will as well. She explained to me that as a Jew, it is fair for her to challenge everything, even the very concept of God. But to Israel, the only thing immune to challenge is the validity of a Jewish state. Israel is willing to do anything, even give up their image, which was already a false image, of being a democratic state and being a homeland for all Jews, in order to try and prevent the inevitable, Gold said. This BDS ban really only strengthens the movement further. It allows the rest of the world to see the hypocrisy that Israel is even more clearly. At the news that the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights was included in the blacklist, Executive Director Youssef Munayer wrote the following in a defiant letter to supporters. We wear this designation as a badge of honor. When Israel, which aims to portray itself to the world as liberal and democratic, blacklists activists dedicated to nonviolent organizing and dissent, it only further exposes itself as a fraud. It is clear to us how effective building the movement for Palestinian rights around the world has become. Our commitment to the rights of Palestinians and our demand to hold Israel account for the denial of these rights is unwavering. As in the effort against apartheid in South Africa, the blacklist and repressive efforts like it will be mere footnotes in the historic march toward freedom, justice, and equality. Okay, that was an article from the Mondelweiss News Service. And BDS marches on. Our featured presentation this week is a recent speech delivered at the United Nations by Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi on the impact of the Balfour Declaration on the Palestinian people. It is presented to a UN committee to advance the rights of the Palestinian people. We are including the entire introduction of the speech by its committee chair, Jerry, from South Africa.
A very good afternoon to you all. It's a pleasure to be here with you. My name is Jerry from South Africa. Today I represent, and I've been asked by the United Nations Committee on the Exercise of the Annual Rights of Palestinian People to take care of the proceedings. I have an honor of welcoming you to today's lecture by Professor Rashid Khalidi on the impact of the Balfour Declaration has had on the Palestinian people. Today's lecture will be broadcast live, so you have to smile all the time. When I say this, you smile. And simultaneously, interpretation will be provided to the extent possible in English and Arabic. Our committee is a subsidiary body of the United Nations General Assembly with a mandate to advance and advocate for the rights of Palestinian people, including their right to self-determination in accordance with international law and the principles of the Charter of the United Nations. Our committee is comprised of 50 members, member states from all the regions of the world, and plays a critical role in mobilizing international support for a peaceful settlement of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Ladies and gentlemen, as we know, 2017 marks the 50th year of the Israeli occupation, which began in 1967, and the 70th anniversary of United Nations resolution to partition Palestine. But it also marks the centenary of the Balfour Declaration. 100 years ago, today, through the darkest days of World War I, the government of the United Kingdom announced its support for the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. A letter sent from the UK Foreign Secretary Alfred Balfour to one of the British most distinguished Jewish citizens and Zionists at the time, Baron Rothschild, changed the course of history of the region forever until now. While Israel has been established according to that partition as a national home for the Jewish people, Palestinians remains in limbo without a sovereign state of their own, and with the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, a small fraction of what constituted Palestine in 1947. Under the continued Israeli occupation, and in view of all of us, including the United Nations, some will argue that the Balfour Declaration was harbinger for future injustices, conflict, and more unfulfilled promises, such as the 1947 partition plan and Oslo agreements and all other subsequent agreements. Today's lecture gives us an opportunity to hear about the profound impact of this declaration has had on Palestinian people from a renowned scholar in the modern Middle East and a member of a prominent Jerusalem family whose representatives have distinguished themselves in the whole walks of life of Palestinian life. Professor Khalidi is an eminent scholar whose research primarily covers the history of the modern Middle East, with a particular focus on ways in which external powers have shaped development and conflict in that area. In his book, I quote, "Palestinian Identity, the Construction of Modern National Consciousness," published in 1997, one of his signature works, Professor Khalidi argues that Arabs living in Palestine began to regard themselves as a distinct people decades before 1948 partition, and the Nakba, or the catastrophe ending in the flight or expulsion of 50% of Arab populations in Palestine from their homes and from their lands. His scholarship provides a cogent rejoinder to Israel's nationalistic narrative that Arabs in Palestine had no collective identity prior to the 1945's creation of Israel. Professor Khalidi has published widely and won numerous awards, including a top honor of the Middle East Studies Association of North America, the Alpha Haruri Book Award for writing the best book in 1997. In addition to teaching and writing, Professor Khalidi was an advisor to Palestinian negotiations team in the early 1990s. Professor Khalidi is uniquely positioned to address today's subject. It is a privilege to have you here today, sir. Thank you for taking time at your busy and hectic schedule to deliver today's lecture. We really appreciate. Now, it's my honor on your behalf to invite Professor Khalidi to deliver his lecture. Afterwards, we will take some few questions. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming, and thank you, Your Excellency, for that generous introduction. It's a great honor to be asked to speak here at the United Nations on the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. I'm grateful to His Excellency Ambassador Fodé-Sek of Senegal, to Ambassador Jerry of South Africa, our chair today, to the entire Committee on the Exercise of the Inalienable Rights of the Palestinian People, and to the dedicated staff of the UN Secretariat for making this event possible. I think it's particularly fitting to be speaking today at the United Nations, which has played such a large role in the tragedy of Palestine. Today, I am going to take you on a short historical journey in which I will address the impact on the Palestinian people of the Balfour Declaration and of the League of Nations mandate that was based on that declaration. I can only hope that if we can all become more aware of this historical background, we, the world community, and the United Nations in particular, may be able to address the harm that was caused by this declaration to the Palestinians and by all that followed in a more fair and a more effective fashion than it has done over the past 70 years. Now, the momentous statement made on behalf of the British Cabinet on November 2, 1917, by Arthur James Balfour, who was His Majesty's Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, is usually looked at in terms of British imperial interests, or in terms of its ostensible subject, a, quote, national home for the Jewish people. We know a great deal about Britain's commitment to Zionism. We know less about what the support of the British Empire via this declaration meant for the aims of Zionism and the Zionist movement, which for nearly half a century proudly described itself as a colonial endeavor, and which at the same time was a national movement in the making. The ultimate objective of political Zionism, as it was laid out by its founder, Theodor Herzl, in his 1896 booklet, Der Judenstaat, was as far-reaching as it was crystal clear. And these aims were never really deviated from. These aims were establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine. That's what the title of the book says, meaning, again, the book stresses this, Jewish sovereignty and control of immigration into the country. Whatever Britain may have intended by the Balfour Declaration, complete and exclusive control over the entirety of Palestine was what the Zionist movement consistently fought for during the ensuing half century and eventually obtained. It did so largely as a result of over two decades of unstinting British support secured via this declaration and via the League of Nations mandate that was based upon the declaration. Now, much of this is well known. However, what I want to talk about today is another aspect of this declaration that is of paramount, that I think is of paramount importance, and that is often ignored. This was the perspective of the people of Palestine, whose future the Balfour Declaration ultimately decided. For the Palestinians, this declaration, this statement, was a gun pointed directly at their heads, particularly in view of the colonialist ambiance of the early 20th century. As I will try to show this afternoon, the Balfour Declaration, in effect, constituted a declaration of war by the British Empire on the indigenous population of the land it was promising to the Jewish people as a national home. This declaration launched what has become a century-long assault on the Palestinian people aimed at implanting and fostering this national home at their expense. Now, some people have argued that Zionism can only be seen as a national movement. Others have argued it's a colonial settler movement. I would argue that one can walk and chew gum at the same time, and that from its inception, Zionism was both a nascent national movement and a colonial enterprise in search of a metropolitan sponsor. After having failed to find that sponsor elsewhere, Chaim Weizmann, the second leader of the Zionist movement after Theodor Herzl, succeeded with the wartime British cabinet. The Zionist movement thereafter had the support of the greatest power of the age, Great Britain, which was about to become one of the victors in World War I. Now, Zionism had been viewed with concern in Palestine as early as the late 19th century. But the Balfour Declaration, when it was finally revealed to Palestinians, meant that their country was now threatened by a far greater danger than they had earlier suspected. Indeed, at the very moment that the Balfour Declaration was issued, British troops were advancing northward through Palestine in pursuit of the retreating Ottoman army, and only 5 weeks after the declaration was issued, British forces entered Jerusalem, December 9th, 1917. The text of the declaration confirmed the nature of this danger. It consisted of a single paragraph of 67 words. I'm going to impose on your patience by reading it to you. 67 words. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. That is the entirety of the Balfour Declaration issued, as we've just heard, to Lord Rothschild, the leader of the Zionist movement. Now, Palestine was an inhabited country in 1917. 94% of its population was Arab. This overwhelming Arab majority in the country that was the object of the Balfour Declaration went unmentioned by his lordship, except in a backhanded way, as the, quote, existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. They were not described as a people. The words Palestinian and Arab do not appear in the text of the declaration. For all intents and purposes, as a national entity, for Lord Balfour, for the British cabinet, they did not exist. They were existing non-Jewish communities and no more. Furthermore, this is extremely important. They were offered only, quote, civil and religious rights. They were not offered political rights. They were not offered national rights. They were not offered representation. They were not described as a people. They were not told that they would have a national home. All of those things applied to the Jewish people, but not to the indigenous majority in Palestine. By way of contrast, Lord Balfour ascribed national rights to the Jewish people, who in 1917 were represented in Palestine by about 6% of the total population. Regarded in this way, Britain's backing for Herzl's aims of Jewish statehood, sovereignty, and control over immigration into Palestine had portentous implications. It meant British support for bringing into Palestine and implanting a foreign majority at the expense of the indigenous population's rights, and ultimately at the expense of its existence as a people in its own land. The Balfour Declaration thus meant that the Palestinians faced the prospect of being outnumbered by unlimited immigration and of losing control of their country to the Zionist drive for sole sovereignty over a country that was then almost completely Arab in population and culture. It took over 3 decades, and the mass expulsion of a little over half of the Arab population of Palestine from their homes in 1948 for these things to happen, but happen they did. Now, I've mentioned that even before World War I, there had been trepidation among the Arabs of Palestine about the rapid progress of the Zionist movement. This became a widespread sentiment as the movement grew in strength and as immigration to Palestine increased. Between 1909 and 1914, the two leading Haifa and Yaffa newspapers, Al-Karmel and Philistine, published over 200 articles warning about the danger of Zionism for the Palestinians. Scores of articles per year in each newspaper. Among the peasantry in areas of intensive colonization, Zionist inroads were felt in concrete terms as land purchase led to the removal of Arab peasants working on the land. Their concerns were shared by Arab city dwellers who observed with mounting concern the constant arrival of new European Jewish immigrants. This was before the war. Once the war had taken place, news of the Balfour Declaration reached Palestine only with much delay after November 2nd. All local newspapers had been closed since the beginning of the war. There were no papers in Palestine. Then, after British troops occupied the country, strict military occupation regime banned news of the declaration from being spread. The British did not want the population to know what they had pledged in the Balfour Declaration. They did not allow newspapers to open for 2 years after 1917. In fact, it was not until 1920 the first Palestinian papers were allowed to reopen. There were other reasons, however, for the delayed Palestinian reaction to the Balfour Declaration. These relate to the extraordinary wartime conditions that prevailed in Palestine and that caused intense suffering. The country had been the scene of more than a year of intense battles between British and Ottoman forces, which continued until 1918, such that by the end of the war, Palestinians were already prostrated and exhausted by severe wartime shortages, famine, penury, dislocation, the requisitioning of draft animals, and the conscription of almost every able-bodied man into the Ottoman army. Of all the major combatant powers, the Ottoman Empire suffered the heaviest wartime death toll. Britain, France, Germany suffered around 4% casualties in their adult male population. The Ottoman death toll was over 3 million dead, or 15% of the total population. Most of these people were civilians. In Greater Syria, including Palestine, there were 500,000 deaths due to famine alone between 1915 and 1918. Civilian deaths were compounded by horrific wartime casualties. 750,000 Ottoman soldiers out of the 2.8 million who had been mobilized died during the war. One in four soldiers died in Ottoman service. The impact of all of these factors on Palestine was intense. It's estimated that after growing over 1% annually in all of the pre-war years, the population of Palestine declined by 6% during World War I. It was against this grim background of mass suffering and the advance of British troops that Palestinians eventually learned about the issuance of the Balfour Declaration. The British tried to prevent them from learning about it, but they did learn about it. The shock of hearing about this promise to the Zionist movement by Lord Balfour was exacerbated by a British occupation that marked the end of 400 years of Ottoman sovereignty, a regime which had prevailed for a full 20 generations, almost twice the lifetime of the American Republic. There was nevertheless a rapid evolution in the way that Palestinians saw themselves during and after World War I. In a world where nationalism had been gaining ground for decades, a world war that had been driven by unrestrained nationalist sentiment provided a major boost to the national idea in Palestine and in other areas of the world. The enhanced salience of nationalism was compounded by the espousal in 1917 by both Woodrow Wilson and Vladimir Lenin of the principle of national self-determination. The endorsement of the national principle by two ostensibly anti-colonial powers had an enormous impact on peoples the world over. As a result of the hopes aroused and then disappointed by Wilson's 14 points, by the Bolshevik Revolution, by the Paris Peace Conference, there were massive anti-colonial upheavals in India, in Korea, in Egypt, and in many other countries. Now, I would argue that as a result of World War I and what followed, the Palestinians were suffering from what might be described as collective post-traumatic stress syndrome. And in a situation like this, they had to face entirely new realities as they entered a new post-war world suffused by nationalist fervor. The Ottoman Empire was now gone. It was replaced by the hegemony of the British and French empires, which in 1915 and 1916 had secretly carried out a self-interested colonial partition of the region, which we know as the Sykes-Picot Accords, that was publicly revealed only in 1917. Against this could be set the possibilities of Arab independence and self-determination, which had been promised secretly by Britain to Sharif Hussein of Mecca in 1916, and which was the subject of repeated British public pledges thereafter. Now, listen closely, because while these British promises were at best partially and belatedly kept as regards other Arab peoples, they were never honored where the Arab population of Palestine was concerned. So while other Middle Eastern countries eventually achieved a measure of independence in the interwar period, no such option was on offer for the Palestinians. In Palestine, Great Britain operated with an entirely different set of rules than in other League of Nations mandates. Unlike all other Class A mandates, so-called, which had been established in the former Arab provinces of the Ottoman Empire, all of which were treated in accordance with Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations as provisionally independent nations, Palestine and Palestine alone was denied such treatment. Instead, Palestine and the Palestinians faced a set of rules rigidly dictated by the terms of the Balfour Declaration, and the declaration, as we know, had been tailored to suit the desiderata of Zionism, a European colonizing project and a national movement which had now acquired as its patron a formidable army, whose armies were just then in the process of conquering Palestine. British troops were not to leave the country for over 30 years, by which time the Zionist enterprise had become firmly entrenched. As soon as they were able to do so, in the wake of World War I, the Palestinians began to challenge vigorously both the form of governance imposed by the British, based on the Balfour Declaration, and the introduction of the Zionist movement as a privileged interlocutor of the British. They did so initially in the shadow of a strict British military occupation regime that lasted until 1920 and was followed by a series of British high commissioners. The first of these high commissioners was Sir Herbert Samuel, a former cabinet minister and dedicated Zionist who laid the governmental foundations for much of what followed. In understanding the unsuccessful efforts of the Palestinians to oppose this regime, two crucial factors are of paramount importance. The first factor is that unlike most other peoples who fell under the sway of colonial rule, the Palestinians had to contend not only with the colonial power in the metropole, but also with the terms of the Balfour Declaration. They thus had to deal with a colonial settler movement, which, while it was beholden to Britain, was independent of Britain, and which had a powerful national impulse and an international base. Most importantly, they had a base in this country, in the United States. The second factor is that Britain did not rule Palestine outright as a colonial possession. It ruled Palestine as a mandatory power of the League of Nations. In rejecting Palestinian protests about the Balfour Declaration, British officials could simply point to the international legitimacy for its terms that was provided by the 1922 League of Nations mandate for Palestine, which, at the instigation of the British themselves, had incorporated verbatim the text of the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration constitutes the introduction to the League of Nations mandate for Palestine. It's the preamble to the mandate. In 7 of the 28 articles of that mandate, there is an effort to substantially amplify and expand on the commitments of the Balfour Declaration. So the mandate is, in effect, an elaboration of the Balfour Declaration. Thus, the British government could hide behind the terms of their League of Nations mandate in denying the Palestinians treatment as an independent nation in accordance with Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations. I would therefore argue that the Palestinians were in a triple bind. This may have been unique in the entire history of the resistance of indigenous peoples to European colonialism. They faced the might of the British Empire in an era between the world wars in which not one single colonial possession, with the partial exception of Ireland, succeeded in freeing itself from the clutches of the European powers. This was not an age of liberation. This was not an age of decolonization. It was an age in which the colonial empires maintained their power. The Palestinians faced as well an international colonizing movement with a national mission and with its own independent sources of finance and support, besides those which were generously offered by Britain. And finally, they were confronted with the international legitimacy that was accorded to British rule by the League of Nations, which had sanctified the Balfour Declaration and its colonial import for the Palestinians by endowing it with the legal imprimatur of the preeminent international body of its day. The Balfour Declaration was thus transmogrified, transformed. It became more than just a statement by the British cabinet. It became an internationally sanctioned legal document. In explaining the failure of the Palestinians to retain control of their ancestral homeland, alongside understanding the shortcomings of their leaders and the hindrances that resulted from fissures within Palestinian society, we must keep in mind the triple bind they were in, facing Britain, Zionism, and international legitimacy. Now, before November 2nd, 1917, the Zionist movement was both a national movement in embryo and a colonial enterprise without a fixed metropole, like an orphan searching for a foster parent. When it found such a parent in Great Britain, as symbolized by the Balfour Declaration, the colonization and transformation of Arab Palestine into a Jewish state could begin in earnest. This process was backed very soon afterwards, as I've suggested, by the international legitimacy provided by the League of Nations mandate. Importantly, however, it was backed as well by an indispensable iron wall of British bayonets, in the words of that most forthright of Zionist leaders, Zev Jabotinsky. It was not just international legitimacy, it was also British bayonets that supported this process. Seen from the perspective of the Palestinian people, the careful, calibrated, diplomatic prose of the Balfour Declaration amounted, as I've suggested, to a declaration of war on them. For the next few decades, this war was waged in several ways. It was waged by the Zionist movement with money, legal means, propaganda, and finally with mortars and car bombs. It was waged by the British Empire with multiple forms of repression, prison camps, exile, summary executions, warplanes, tanks, and artillery. By the end of the Arab Revolt in Palestine in 1939, 10% of the adult male population of Palestine was dead, wounded, imprisoned, or in exile. That is a very heavy weight of British repression employed in service of this project. The issuance of the Balfour Declaration, therefore, I submit, marked the beginning of a century-long colonial conflict in Palestine, supported by an array of outside powers. In much different forms, this conflict continues until this day. Now, I realize that I may have imposed on your patience by summarizing some of the history around the Balfour Declaration and how it affected the Palestinians. Some would say that we should forget history in dealing with the Palestine conflict. I would suggest that those who say something along these lines have an absolutely miserable track record of failure in attempting to resolve the core issues at stake, specifically the conflict between the Palestinian and Israeli peoples. Ignoring history is one of the things that has brought us to where we are in 2017. In fact, I would argue, I'm a historian, so I would do this, but I would nevertheless argue that this historical background is essential to understanding why this conflict has lasted for so long and is essential to understanding how it might be justly resolved. This background also helps us to understand that it did not begin in 1967 or in 1948, as some short-sighted observers would have it. Finally, this background points out the avenue towards a real, lasting, sustainable peace and towards real reconciliation and compromise between the Palestinian and Israeli peoples. Reconciliation, as the South Africans can attest, depends on acknowledging historical realities rather than ignoring them. Genuine compromise must be based on justice and absolutely equal treatment and absolutely equal rights for all. It must not, it cannot be based on the imposition of the will of the stronger on the weaker. That is not compromise. That is something else. I would argue that this historical background points to another fact. And this is something that I can say here in a body that has over 200 members, most of which are not great powers. What I am about to say may offend the great powers, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. I'm not a diplomat. I can say whatever I please. And this fact is the following. It is that peace between Palestine and Israel is far too important to be left to the self-interested ministrations of the great powers alone. Again and again, the history of the League of Nations, the history of the United Nations, show us that these great powers were responsible for imposing formulas in Palestine that suited their interests of the moment. In every single case, these formulas created, exacerbated, and magnified this conflict. In so doing, these great powers have ignored international law, and they have ignored essential elements of the covenants and charters that they themselves helped to shape, such as the principle of self-determination that animates both the covenant of the League of Nations and the Charter of the United Nations. If there's one defining principle behind those two documents, crafted essentially by the great powers of the day themselves, it is the principle of self-determination. It's this principle that has been ignored in one respect in Palestine. As someone who is the son of an international civil servant who faithfully served the United Nations for his entire career, I have been a close witness for many decades to the failures of this body, of the United Nations, to live up to its principles where Palestine is concerned. I was sitting in the Security Council chamber as a visitor when the United Nations Security Council attempted to pass a ceasefire resolution in June 1967. I used to come to this building all the time. There was no security in those days. One could enter very easily. So I have witnessed episode after episode after episode of this failure, which I would ascribe largely to the machinations of the great powers. I am not naive, however. And as a historian, I know all too well that power has its prerogatives. We see that most clearly, of course, in the Security Council. But the United Nations was not set up to make the world a more comfortable place for the powerful, but rather to bring peace with justice and to bring the rule of international law. Over the 100 years since the Balfour Declaration was issued, over the 70 years since the passage of UN General Assembly Resolution 181 in this month in 1947, in the 50 years since the adoption of UN Security Council Resolution 242 in this month in 1967, neither peace with justice nor the rule of law has prevailed where Palestine is concerned. It is high time for the United Nations and the entire world community to act in this spirit. Specifically, after a full century, it is high time that the establishment of a national home promised by Balfour and the League of Nations to the Jewish people in 1917 and afterwards be matched by the establishment of a national home for the Palestinian people. After 70 full years, it is high time that the national self-determination promised to the Israeli people by the United Nations General Assembly in November 1947 and that the Israeli people have enjoyed since 1948 be enjoyed by the Palestinian people. And after 50 full years, it is high time for the injunction in UN Security Council resolution forbidding, quote, the acquisition of territory by war to be vigorously enforced where the territories occupied in 1967 are concerned. Finally, it is high time for the United Nations and for the entire international community to take vigorous action, belatedly, to break the century-old logjam created and perpetuated by the great powers. This man-made logjam has prevented the principle of self-determination from being applied fairly and equally to both parties of this conflict, the Palestinian and Israeli peoples. They both deserve the peace and stability that only an equitable resolution of the conflict between them on the basis of international law and in a spirit of justice and equality would bring. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Palestinian historian Rashi Khalidi speaking at the UN on the impact of the Balfour Declaration on the Palestinian people.
This is, don't you? It's a time space warp.
I'm not sure I know exactly what that is.
I don't suppose anybody really does. We've seen some strange things tonight. Strange creatures that we know don't belong on our planet. God only knows where they came from.
Jenny and Beth.
The vortex took them. Just took them away.
to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The organ harvesting scandal you haven't heard of, and why might that be? Which nation is responsible for this kind of evil? It's not Russia, I'll give you a clue. The Gulen movement, what is it? Former CIA agent Paul Williams spoke to Sean Stone on RT America recently all about the Gulen training camps for jihadis inside the US, how it links through to our very own European Operation Gladio in the 1980s, where NATO's secret military intelligence cells were blowing us up, innocent civilians all over Europe, and blaming it on the Soviets. And is Lebanon hacking our smartphones so they can use them as microphones to spy on us? That's, on the face of it, a ludicrous fake news which has been circulating the globe today. Is it even possible? And the latest edition of the BBC's House of Saud series by former Conspiracy Files producer Mike Rudin. Is this a brave new investigative journalism breakthrough out of the BBC mould? Or just even more sophisticated propaganda? Our sister show Dialects back here at BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. You can be sure to catch it online. This week we hear from the Grenfell Tower Action Group's Joe Delaney. A full interview with him. We had a little part on this show last week. And on there, you can also hear an interview from one of the actresses from the BBC's 1979 and 1980 20 million viewers an episode Shoestring series filmed in Bristol. The full two series is just out for the first time on DVD after 40 years. That's Dialect on BCFM at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. Anyway, Martin, we'll start with this horrific story about organ trafficking. The Israeli organ trafficking network Kingpin has been arrested in Cyprus after a decade on the run. This was being reported about a week and a half ago. I've only just come across it. Fascinating. Reuters has been reporting on it, etc. But really no reporting of anything in the British news about it. An Israeli man who allegedly headed up an international organ trafficking operation has been arrested by police in Cyprus. Moshe Harel stands accused of leading the network, which is said to have operated in the Balkan state of Kosovo around a decade ago, along with his associates. Police claim he lured potential donors from countries across Eastern Europe and Russia and Turkey and Central Asia before removing their organs and leaving them with no medical aftercare once operation had been carried out.
Well, I mean, this has been going on for many years. Most people don't realise it, but poor people all over the world are preyed upon by these kind of criminals. And, you know, there is a market. We were talking about marketisation of the health service in the first hour. There is a market for these organs. And it's, you know, literally poor people are having organs ripped out of their bodies and they are then sold on at a profit to wealthy people. It's as crude as that.
Donors received as little as €12,000 in exchange for one of their kidneys, which would then be sold to wealthy recipients for nearly 10 times that price. So that's 120,000. It's quite a good markup, isn't it? 90%. The majority of recipients who bought organs from the trafficking gang were Israelis, according to the prosecutors. It's been claimed some donors never even received payment once their organs had been removed. Commenting on Harold's detention, police spokesman Baki Kelani said, based on an international arrest warrant, the suspect MH was arrested a few days ago in Cyprus. He's been wanted in a person since 2010. So he's been on the run for around about 8 years. This is Interpol, effectively, that have done this.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm glad that he's been caught. But, of course, I mean, we're pushing in this country towards the idea that when people die, that their organs should be, unless they've opted out, their organs should be available to the health service to be provided to others. And I think that's probably the right policy. But
surely people should be given the choice to opt in if they want.
Well, no, that's been the previous policy. But yeah. The Welsh Assembly has agreed that, and this is the talk is of this.
I mean, surely you have a presumption that the person themselves should decide this, not the health service.
No, you can opt. I think it's better to have an opt out. If people want to opt out, it shouldn't be compulsory. But the problem is, unless you're going to go into the illegal market to buy organs, there is insufficient organs to be transferred under the National Health Service. It's like blood donorship.
So is this just a simple thing of demand and supply, just like
It shouldn't be based on market criteria at all. I'm perfectly happy for people to take my organs if I die in a car accident, and if they're useful to somebody, that they should be used.
Well, you can get yourself a kidney donor card.
Well, indeed, but I mean, the point is, Tony, that they're moving towards, and it's already happened in Wales, you can opt out, but if you don't opt out, then your organs are there to be used by the health service, not to make a profit for this kind.
Back to this Israeli network. Harold is said to have led a gang of 9 people who rang the trafficking network out of a clinic in a residential area of Pristina. Lufti Dervishi, the director of the clinic, was jailed alongside his son Arban for their parts in the conspiracy in their absence in 2013. They were handed sentences of 8 and 7 years respectively for their part in the network's activities. Both men went into hiding and have yet to serve their jail terms. Sentencing the men at the time alongside 3 others, Judge Dean Pinellis said their victims lived in extreme poverty. They could not speak the local language and had little idea what was happening to them, and nobody to look out for their interests. But this is quite clearly, there is an Israeli end to this as well, which is what bothers me. We're being told that Israel is a democracy, and yet people are having stolen organs transplanted into them in Israel.
Yes, but I think it's not just Israelis who are involved in this evil trade. I mean, in Latin America, it's been going on for years. I think the problem is the marketization of human life, which is implied by all of this, is the real problem. That's why we've got a National Health Service which isn't based upon financial criteria, in theory.
So, yes, between 80,000 and 100,000 euros, is that about the price of a kidney?
Well, I don't know, because I've never bought one. But, I mean, if you think back to the scandal of blood donors in the 1980s, where the Tory government of the era decided to buy blood from the United States, which all turned out to be infected, because the people who sell blood are people people who are addicted to drugs and so on, selling blood to make money. And, of course, loads and loads of people were given blood products which were infected. And, of course, if you're going to have people giving blood as a donation, you can't at the same time say, well, other people are going to sell their blood. So it's one or the other. You either have a market-based system where people sell blood, or you have a system where people voluntarily give blood or organs or whatever, and it's not based on any kind of financial criteria.
Do you want to guess how this scandal came to light?
No, I'm
okay,
not
I'll
going
tell
to
you.
Tell me.
The organ scandal came to light in 2008 when a Turkish man was stopped at Pristina Airport, visibly in pain, having just had his kidney removed. The trafficking ring acted out of the Medicis clinic on a residential road on the outskirts of Pristina. How do we stop this sort of thing, Martin? Because this guy's been on the run, everyone else it seems has been on the run, and yet this particular chap, Moshe Harold, in Cyprus, but it seems that surely the EU should have a role here in making sure that any countries which are within the European Union have some sort of effective policing to stop these people travelling.
Well, Kosovo isn't part of the European Union as yet. And of course, Kosovo is a failed state.
Cyprus.
Like many other
What about Cyprus?
Well, Cyprus, it's in Cyprus that he's been arrested because it's not quite a failed state. But the fact of the matter is that poor people all over the world in desperate circumstances will either A, sell blood, or B, if under certain circumstances, sell their organs because they're desperate. And we've actually got to actually move towards, as I say, a non-market based healthcare system which isn't based on financial criteria.
So, what about the next story, which is Lebanon hacking our smartphones? What do you make of that one?
Well, I'm surprised. Who in Lebanon Why Lebanon? I mean, we all know that phones can be hacked, but why are the Lebanese in the frame for this?
It's intelligence, Lebanese intelligence services. They've been turning targets' Android phones into little spy phones. That's at least according to the Financial Times, Reuters, The Telegraph and The New York Times.
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that we all know that electronic equipment is not secure and that the National Security Agency of the United States virtually watches everybody using their phones. And if the Lebanese intelligence services are also engaged in this, it wouldn't surprise me. But I can't see why the Lebanese in particular have been picked on here, and in actual fact, of course, there are different forces at work in Lebanon. You know, it's not even clear what the state's actually quite fractured. So who are we talking about here? And this is
The people reporting this it's basically saying Lebanon's internal intelligence agency. Because what they're saying is effectively that it's generally only state level intelligence services that have got the ability to do this kind of thing. Although,
why pick on Lebanon when we know that the United States and Britain, we've got GCHQ just up the road here. What do you think they spend their days doing? They spend their days hacking people's phones. But of course, we're pointing the finger at the Lebanese as if they're the evil kind of...
New York Times is saying is that Lebanon's internal intelligence agency appears to have been caught spying on thousands of people. Well, appears to... including journalists and military personnel in more than 20 countries, according to researchers at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and Lookout, a private mobile security company. The spy operation apparently is among dozens around the world uncovered by human rights groups and technical organisations. Now, this is the EFF, which, I suppose once upon a time it was quite good, but it doesn't really now seem to be, making much sense. This story doesn't make much sense to me. And he's basically saying that this is a pressure group plus private internet security firm based in the US that's saying this.
Yeah, well, I think the fact of the matter is that Lebanon is in the firing line for regime change. That is definitely what's been going on. That's why Rafi Hariri was summoned by the Saudi prince to justify his behaviour and so on. And because of the fact that in Syria things aren't going the way of the Gulf Cooperation Council
and the
Western powers want.
Frontier Foundation call themselves the leading non-profit defending digital privacy, free speech and innovation. And they're actually sometimes quite critical of the NSA.
Well, I mean, they should be, because the NSA, quite clearly, is the biggest organisation on the planet which is involved in this kind of stuff.
Just take us once more through the motives that the NSA might be trying to frame the Lebanese, and how might they be doing it?
Well, it's not the NSA, it's the Americans, or the US, and the British, and the Israelis, and the Saudis. Lebanese, they're not very happy with the situation in Lebanon, because Hezbollah are in the government. Hezbollah are aligned with the Christian community. Rafi Hariri is a representative, as it were, of the Sunni community in Lebanon, which is the biggest community but not the majority. And, after the civil war in Lebanon, it's quite a delicate balance to keep everybody's interests represented in the central government. And the Israelis are very hostile to the Lebanese government precisely because it does have Hezbollah as part of that, a part of the government. And I think we've got to watch out, because there's quite a possibility that the intelligence service, Western intelligence services and the Saudis are attempting to foment civil war in Lebanon. And therefore the Lebanese secret service are probably taking their own steps to try and prevent that. And of course they're then being singled out for being terrible people for spying on people's phones. I mean, that's what intelligence services do. That's what GCHQ does. And of course it's not right, and there ought to be safeguards and so on and so forth. But why pick on the Lebanese? What do you think the Saudis do all day? Do you think they sit there it's only the Lebanese that spy on people's phones? Seems a bit odd to me.
Abu Hamza said he was, this is another story, Abu Hamza says he was tipped off about 9/11 4 days before the attacks. Hate preacher Abu Hamza said he was tipped off about 9/11 4 days before the horrendous terror attacks on New York City. This was the Express on Monday. The hook-handed former imam from Finsbury Park claims he received a phone mail from terrorists in Afghanistan who told him something will happen very soon. The revelation comes from court documents as the 59-year-old is launching an appeal claiming conditions in the Supermax prison in Colorado where he's being held breach his human rights. Hamza also claims British spies were hacking his phone at the time, raising questions as to whether the UK was withholding information from America. The court documents seen by the Sunday Times also reveal Hamza was an agent for MI5 and Special Branch, going by the code name... Would you like to guess his code name? No. Damson Berry.
Well, there we are. You see, and Abu Hamza, who was broadcast all over the British media as this evil imam with a Captain Hook and all the rest of it, and it turns out that he was working for MI5 all the time.
And Special Branch.
And Special Branch. And, of course, he infiltrated Finsbury Park Mosque, caused all kinds of troubles for the authorities in the mosque there. And, of course, he was actually working for the state. And, of course, it's not really a secret. Everybody knows that Al-Qaeda, for example, who are under attack in Idlib as we speak from the Syrian army, is Al-Qaeda, and they're supported by the British, US and Saudi state. They always have been. There's nothing new about this. And, of course, that's underlying everything. The so-called Sunni, Wahhabi, Salafi terrorists are tools of Western states. Meanwhile, we're banging on about how the Lebanese Secret Service are trying to spy. Presumably the Lebanese Secret Service is trying to spy to find out what the hell these other people are
The reason that he's complaining is because he's not allowed fresh air, and even when he does get occasional fresh air, he's kept in a cage away from other inmates, presumably so he can't discuss anything with them, after being a British agent. What do you think the actual... I'd really like to guess what sort of things would have been going on between Special Branch, MI5, and Abu Hamza in the run-up to the London bombings?
Well, the fact of the matter is that they create... he was used very much to create the image of Muslims as being crazy people and all the rest of it. And of course, Abu Hamza's right-hand man, Harun Aswat, was named by the Metropolitan Police as the mastermind of 7-7, had been on the phone to all four alleged bombers in the week before the attack. But, of course, what they've done with Hamza and with Harun Aswad is they've magicked them away into their secret detention...
To the US.
Facility. That's right.
Outside British jurisdiction.
We can't have a trial. And, of course, if Hamza came to trial for being involved in 7-7, he'd say, yes, I was involved in 7-7, but I was working for the British state all the time.
Say, for example, Graham Fawkes, who we had on this show a few weeks ago, who lost his son in the 7-7 bombings, wanted to bring a private prosecution against Abu Hamza or against Harun Aswat. The courts would just throw up their hands and say, sorry, he's outside our jurisdiction.
Well, this is the whole problem with their non-legal breaking of habeas corpus and just putting people into legal limbo as suspected terrorists who can be just locked up indefinitely. And people say, well, I don't want these people running around. Somebody needs to lock them up. But the fact is what they do is they're protecting the secret services of the West from from being investigated for what they've been doing all along, which is actually orchestrating Salafi terrorism. We are allies with Saudi Arabia. Their chaps are all trained at Sandhurst. Our military are over there at the minute. There are RAF personnel. There are people from the Scottish regiments working over there. They are our close allies. And we worked with them to try and turn Syria into a graveyard. And that's what we've been doing over the last 5 and 10 years. And there's no dispute about it. That's what's been going on.
One of the stories I missed over Christmas, apologies, folks, should have really been doing that last week, or the week before, but was on The Intercept, which I would suggest everyone bookmarks. It's a fantastic, excellent. It's where the Edward Snowden leaks first came from over in Brazil. And Glenn Greenwald was writing there on the 30th of December last year a story saying Facebook says it's deleting accounts at the direction of the US and Israeli governments. In September of last year, we noted, he says, that Facebook representatives were meeting with the Israeli government to determine which Facebook accounts of Palestinians should be deleted on the grounds that they constituted incitement. The meetings, called for and presided over by one of the most extremist and authoritarian Israeli officials, pro-settlement justice minister Ayelet Shaked, came after Israel threatened Facebook that its failure to voluntarily comply with Israeli deletion orders would result in the enactment of laws requiring Facebook do so upon pain of being severely fined or even blocked in the country. The predictable results of those meetings are now clear and well documented ever since Facebook has been on a censorship rampage against Palestinian activists who protest the decades-long illegal Israeli occupation, all directed and determined by Israeli officials. Indeed, Israeli officials have been publicly boasting about how obedient Facebook is when it comes to Israel censorship orders. And it's just to quote one of them, shortly after news broke early this month of the agreement between the Israeli government and Facebook, Israeli Justice Minister Eilat Shaked said Tel Aviv had submitted 158 requests to the social media giant over the previous 4 months, asking it to remove content it deemed incitement. She said Facebook had granted 95% of those requests.
Well, I mean, these big tech companies, which were basically set up by the CIA, effectively, are being used very, very much so in 2018. We can see the totalitarian direction of travel of what's going on. People used to think that the internet was a place where you could get all sorts of opinions and find out what people thought about things. But Ahed Tamimi, the 16-year-old that was still in prison for supposedly slapping Israeli soldiers, they've taken down her Facebook, because they don't want her to communicate to the world at large about what's going on there. And I think we've seen an increase in censorship from all of these organisations in recent months. And this is because, as we've discussed off air many's the time, we're possibly moving towards World War III, and therefore they need to have much tighter control over the means of communication before the balloon goes up.
And what about the potential of that World War III to be sparked in Israel or around that part of the world?
Well, the Middle East in general is the most likely place for it to start. But of course, the problem is we've also got Southeast Asia on tenterhooks as well.
I suppose you know in a way you have to do that censorship in order to create massive tension between different parties in order to get a war going. This is what the Israelis call conflict initiation.
Yeah, well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that they've been pushing very strongly to try and the algos that Google are using now is derating lots of alternative news sources. The whole stuff about fake news, fake media, Russians fixing elections all over the place. It's a huge propaganda barrage, so that they can then claim that anybody, people like us, that criticise what they're doing. People shouldn't be allowed to listen to us, okay, because we're clearly inciting and so on and so forth.
Facebook deleted David Icke's Facebook page, but it was restored 6 days after it was what they call unpublished. 6 days in which Facebook apparently ignored the requests. Facebook called it an error. And I'm sure, says Andrew Cheatham on the davidicke.com website, everyone will believe them.
Well, I think what happened there is they overplayed their hand. I mean, Icke, I don't particularly agree with Icke, but he's got many people who follow him. And then Facebook declares him an un-person, and people are immediately suspicious. I mean, how can you declare somebody like that who's a public figure with loads and loads and loads of people following their pronouncements, and then just declare that they don't exist and you can't hear them anymore? This is the problem all censors have always had. Once you start censoring things, people say, well, I want to listen to that. I don't agree with David Icke, but if somebody wants to shut him up, I want to hear him.
Zero Hedge is a website which was called Fake News originally by Obama and Clinton and all that original stuff that we heard just a few days after Google had launched their anti-fake news app. Mm-hmm. You know, that then you saw, actually, no, it was Barack Obama and Angela Merkel, I think, that announced the whole anti-fake news campaign for Google. You have to imagine that that's what they're doing over in Germany a year before last, November, I think it was. Anyway, one of their stories this week, of course, must be fake news, because we're told that it's not official government-approved news, is that China's official military newspaper is warning war is not far. This is regional situations around China are complex and unstable. Dangers are hiding under the peace. China cannot afford a military failure, so we must be fully aware of potential crisis and prepare for battle at all times. When the country is on the brink of becoming a great military power, it's also stepping into a period with high risks to national security. This is an official of the People's Liberation Army wrote in the People's Liberation Army newspaper. The article first headlined last week at the PLA Daily, "A soldier without desire for war preparedness is not a good soldier." The newspaper warned that Chinese soldiers are not ready for combat because many refused to believe that war is imminent. Military experts agree the threat of conflict around China has increased massively in recent years.
Yes, I mean, and how can anybody claim that zero hedge by reporting what the People's Liberation Army of China have made as a public statement are putting out fake news? It's a fact that the PLA have said this in their own newspaper. That's an official Chinese government
position. They're saying
position.
War is not far away. That's what they're saying.
Yes, well, Tillerson...
I mean, surely they're just trying to wind up their troops.
Well, of course, but Tillerson and Trump this week have been saying, both of them, that there's probably no peaceful solution in Korea. Now, in actual fact, there's no military solution in Korea, so they shouldn't be saying that at all. There is no military solution, but they're saying that it's quite possible that there's no peaceful solution. Now, if there is a military strike on North Korea by the Western powers, probably including the RAF, for example, and the Royal Navy, then the Chinese have already made their position clear. They will fight back on the side of the North Koreans. So all this stuff about whether North Korea has got a missile that can hit the United States or not is irrelevant, because if you go to war with China, they definitely have got missiles which can hit the United States. So in other words, we're talking, if we don't go nuclear, we're going to have a conventional war in Korea, but the Chinese will be fighting with the North Koreans against the West and against the United States. But I think the one useful and quite hopeful thing that's happened is that the North Koreans and the South Koreans have decided to open negotiations with each other in a very tentative way. And, of course, the Americans just had a meeting to try and isolate North Korea, where they didn't invite China or Russia. And they are attempting to try and recreate the coalition that fought the Korean War in the 1950s. And, of course, if we have a Korean War, which won't necessarily be a nuclear war, the Chinese are much closer to Korea than the United States or Britain. And if there's a non-nuclear conventional war in Korea, the Chinese People's Liberation Army will win. They will. There's no doubt about it. And I think that the Americans have never won a war since World War II, not even one, unless you include things like Grenada, and they will get a bloody nose, and they will deserve one if they start
it. In the background to all of this, Martin, is money, of course. A couple of interesting stories. One is that the Brexit hit pound helped the UK boat and yacht industry notch its highest revenue since the financial crisis. Sterling's collapse, sparked primarily by Brexit jitters, has helped the marine industry rake in £3.12 billion. Last year, they're up something between 3% and 4% on the previous years. But more to the point, Forbes 2017 billionaires list: meet the richest people on the planet. Forbes say it was a record year for the richest people on earth, as the number of billionaires jumped 13% to, there's at least there's some good figures there, to 2,043 from 1,810 last year. First time ever Forbes has pinned down more than 2,010 figure fortunes. Their total net worth rose by 18% to $7.67 trillion, also a record. The change in the number of billionaires, up 233 since 2016, was the biggest in 31 years that Forbes has been tracking billionaires globally.
Crisis, what crisis for the people at the top, eh? The 0.1% are making out like bandits as a result of the bailout of the financial services sector 10 years ago this year. And that's what's going on. The money is being sucked to the top, to these people, through manipulation, financial and government manipulation. And the poor are being ground into the floor in Britain and elsewhere.
The man behind your Windows computer, Windows 10, which sort of updates itself. If I was you folks, I'd take your computer back to somebody that knows what they're doing and get Windows 7 put on it, because 10 is an absolute nightmare. As soon as you need to use it, we were in a studio actually trying to record somebody, and it said, no, you can't switch the computer on. And it took about 2 hours for it to actually do its updates and to even switch on. You know, I used to think when you turned a TV on back in the old days, the old Valve TVs, and you had to wait half a minute for the screen to come up, that was bad. But, the Windows 10 computers are absolutely appalling. Anyway, Bill Gates, he's the number one richest for the fourth year in a row and the richest person in the world by far for 18 of the past 23 years. His fortune was last year $75 billion. What do you think it is this year, Martin?
100 billion?
No, you're overestimating. He's only gone up to 86 billion. Ah. So that's actually only 11 billion he's managed to make this year. I don't know quite how he's going to spend all that. Maybe on... how do they spend their money these days?
Well, they create foundations to do good and give their money away. And they also... You know,
to little radio shows like ours?
Well, no, they use their money as a means of political influence. Somebody like Rupert Murdoch doesn't need another red cent. He's super wealthy, but of course, what his money gives him is the power to make and break governments. And of course, that's what we're really talking about here. If money is power, and that's what they're really after. Bill Gates, you have to listen to Bill Gates. When Bill Gates opens his mouth, everybody has to go, yes sir, no sir, three bags full sir.
I noticed we've seen a sort of film of the Queen, quite a lot of that on the TV more recently. It's almost like she seems to be using her Royal Charter powers at the BBC to say, well, you know, let's have a load stuff about me on here.
Well, yes, I mean, the fact of the matter is that the rigging of stock markets and quantitative easing all over the world has been a win-win for the wealthy classes. So the government's intervention they're not against government intervention as long as it's helping them, and that's effectively what's happened.
At the other end of the scale, at least the Mirror this week is telling us 13,000 heroic soldiers have been left homeless after leaving the military, and almost all have PTSD. A Sunday People probe reveals how hundreds of British veterans are reduced to sleeping in doorways and begging from passers-by, and then probably being arrested by Bristol City Council's litter police or some similar person. Military charity said the shameful figure is a record high and the government is failing those who risk their lives for Queen and country. 13,000, Martin.
Well, it's hardly surprising, is it? We know what goes on. And this is the world we live in.
That's a division, a couple of divisions there, maybe. Maybe they could be gotten together and do something about their plight.
Well, I saw that there was an SAS guy that was involved in the Iranian embassy siege who's been made homeless. And in fact, the SAS are paying for him to have a bed and breakfast accommodation. And of course, it's not just ex-military people who are homeless. Universal Credit, which we didn't mention in the first hour, is basically a homelessness machine, because private sector landlords won't rent to people on Universal Credit, which is why they've been unable to roll it out, even in years and years and years of attempting to roll it out. Because it's basically a sentence of homelessness on anybody who's put on it. And, of course, that's been obvious from the get-go, but the government has never taken any notice of that, and they're just proceeding blithely on with the policy of they won't pay landlords directly, as they used to do on housing benefit, and on that basis the private sector won't house people. It's just a deliberate own goal.
Well, when many of these soldiers would have served in Northern Ireland, I would say possibly even the majority of them, and so this is a subject that came up at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday too.
Mr. David Simpson.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister will be aware that Northern Ireland has not had a government now for over a year. Decisions need to be taken to protect our health service, education and local communities. Does the Prime Minister agree that in the absence of a government being formed, it is imperative that her government takes the decision to appoint direct rule ministers as soon as possible so that a budget can be put forward to deal with this urgent problem?
We are committed to re-establishing a fully functioning, inclusive, devolved administration that works for everyone in Northern Ireland. I don't underestimate the challenges that remain involved here, but we still believe that a way forward can be found and an agreement can be reached. And I would say it's imperative, therefore, that the parties re-engage in intensive discussions aimed at resolving the outstanding issues so that the Assembly can meet and an executive can be formed. We do recognise, however, that we have a responsibility to ensure political stability and good governance in Northern Ireland, obviously, as I say, our priority is on ensuring that we can work with the parties to re-establish the devolved government in Northern Ireland, but we recognise the need to ensure that Northern Ireland can continue to operate and that public services can continue to be provided.
Well, I mean, obviously, as has just been pointed out, there hasn't been a devolved administration for over a year in Northern Ireland.
This is back to direct rule, isn't it? Which is effectively a failure that happened to be instituted during the Troubles.
Yes. But, I mean, one of the things that may be going on here from Sinn Féin's side is that they don't want to carry out a cuts policy. And therefore, if there's direct rule, it'll be the British government based in London which is carrying out cuts in Northern Ireland, and Sinn Féin are simply going to oppose them.
Well, they could oppose them from within government, surely.
Yeah, but then they'd be in the same position as
that's
Marvin.
A bit like Labour Party.
They would be in the same position as Marvin Rees here,
like,
in Bristol.
Yeah, it's a bit like the Labour Party not putting up a candidate in Bristol, isn't it? Because they didn't want to do cuts.
No, well, I mean, the point about Sinn Féin is they're in a different position. They don't take their seats in the British Parliament. If they did take their seats in the British Parliament, of course, that would completely change the arithmetic on Brexit, for example.
Yes, have a think about that, Sinn Féin, please.
Because
there is the DUP angle here as well, of course, because DUP are actually keeping Theresa May in Downing Street.
Well, indeed. So, in other words, Irish politics are central to British politics. The Irish question is still the question, as it was in the 19th century.
So is Theresa May not going to institute back the Northern Ireland Assembly because the DUP are telling her not to?
I'm not quite sure what's going on there. If both sides in Northern Ireland can agree to form an administration, that's probably the best thing for all concerned. But there's no reason particularly why Sinn Féin should help out the DUP and Theresa May. Let's have direct rule, and then you can cut libraries, schools and hospitals, and we're just going to oppose you.
OK, we're going to go a little bit more deeply into Northern Ireland now and into some of the history there, because there was military intelligence units over there which were being used by the military to undermine Harold Wilson, Martin, weren't there, back in the 1970s?
Well, that's right, because they were engaged in psychological warfare operations inside Northern Ireland, but they were also engaged in psychological warfare operations against the Labour government. And in fact, the election of a Tory government in the early 1970s probably prolonged the conflict by enormously, because the possibility of a Labour government basically taking a hard line with the Unionists was undermined by the British Army at that stage, because they were basically privately educated Tories.
Weren't some of the people in the British Army actually, didn't they rather like the Troubles, because it gave them a kind of live exercise?
Well, exactly. So it was a great for training and all the rest of it, and they can then start planning the sort of thing that they wanted to do in Britain as a whole.
And other parts of the world, possibly.
Indeed.
I mean, it was one of the first big sort of sectarian conflicts, which was blamed on religion, wasn't it? Blamed on the Protestants and the Catholics. Actually, there was much more to it to that.
Well, that there were various dimensions to the conflict, and there still are.
Well, you could also look at it as a sort of parallel with the Shia-Sunni thing that's been going on in the Middle East.
Well, you could, and the fact of the matter is that this kind of thing has been going on. You know, the British did have an empire. I mean, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is because of the British Empire. The fighting in Sri Lanka between Tamils and Sinhalese, that's the British Empire. The fact that India and Pakistan are still at daggers drawn and they've both got nuclear weapons, that's the British Empire. And if you actually look around the world, you'll see that most conflicts, virtually all conflicts around the world, the British Empire was at the root of them.
Divide and rule. So who was Colin Wallis?
Colin Wallis was an army intelligence officer who was involved in psychological warfare operations in Northern Ireland, and then eventually blew the whistle because the psychological warfare operations that he was involved in were basically involved with undermining the Labour government in Britain. So far from being the intelligence services being a tool of the government, they were being used against the Labour government. And of course, they weren't being used against Tory governments because they're basically Tories. And you've got to recognise that we don't live in a fully functioning democracy when the secret agencies of the state are in fact engaged in political chicanery of this kind.
But he was also approached by somebody because they thought he was a decent guy from the Kinkora boys' home as a whistleblower.
That's right. And of course, Kinkora is a key issue, and I think we're going to discuss it now. But of course, it wasn't just in Northern Ireland that children's homes were being used by elite paedophiles, and therefore allowed the intelligence services to use them as means of blackmail on various politicians.
OK, so before we hear from Colin, do you think that was really what it was about, political blackmail?
Yes, I mean the intelligence services have this phrase: mice, money, ideology, coercion, ego, and of course coercion involves where you basically engineer somebody to have sex with an underage person, and then you video it or photograph it, and then those people are blackmailable, and that's why they do it.
Okay, well, let's hear the BBC interview from about 20 years ago now, a little excerpt from this chat with Colin Wallace, and you might find some of this disturbing. It also might be an idea to make sure young children aren't listening.
In 1972, I received a phone call from a social worker, and she said she had some information for the security forces and arranged to meet me. And I can remember the woman fairly clearly, slightly plump, round face. I can remember she was wearing glasses with fairly large spectacle frames. She told me that she had been involved in the supervision of one particular boy from West Belfast, who claimed to have been sexually abused at the Kinkora boys' home in Belfast. She said that she and her colleagues had raised the matter with the authorities, but nothing had been done. The basic story was that boys in the home were being abused, but also boys from the home were taken out or went out to pre-arranged meetings with individuals in the surrounding area. And the main reason that we were interested was that there were strong links with the loyalist paramilitary community, particularly in East Belfast. I was surprised that, bearing in mind the nature of the allegations, and particularly bearing in mind the fact that we had good working relationships with the RUC, that nothing had been done a year later. And I wrote a fairly strongly worded memo highlighting my concern about the lack of any activity in that respect. I think, too, first of all, I felt very frustrated that nothing had happened. And the fact that children were being abused when they were in the care of the authorities seemed particularly horrific.
In fact, systematic sex abuse at Kinkora would continue unchallenged for another 6 years. Significantly, it would later emerge that the loyalist paramilitary leader who ran the home was also working for MI5. After sending his angry memo, Colin Wallace, who had been promoted just weeks earlier, suddenly found himself a very unpopular man.
After I had written the memo about Kinkora, and after I had decided not to go ahead with Clockwork Orange, I felt life would settle down and I could get back into much more of my traditional form of working. But suddenly, out of the blue, without any warning, David McDyne, the Chief Information Officer at Northern Ireland, told me that I had been requested to go to Minister Defence as a matter of urgency just before Christmas. And in fact, the only time that I could manage to do it comfortably was on Christmas Eve, which was really the beginning of my holiday. So I travelled to Minister Defence main building, and it was a strange and quite hostile interview, which I didn't expect. Very brisk. I was summoned to his office. He said quite bluntly, after a pleasantry, that they had information that my life was in danger and that I was being moved out of Northern Ireland as a matter of urgency.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the Clockwork Orange, and of course that was the code name for the attempt to basically undermine the then Labour government.
But it wasn't an attempt, it worked.
Mm, yeah, it did. Wilson resigned, and eventually the government was forced out. And of course that sort of thing still goes on. And of course boys from Kinkora weren't just abused at Kinkora, they were also then taken off to be to London and other places. And it's not, and in Northern Ireland this Kinkora affair is pretty well known. But of course the suspicion is that other places like Haute-la-Garenne in Jersey were also being used in a similar way by the intelligence services to entrap and blackmail politicians. And I'm afraid there's a very dark underbelly to British imperialism, and it's always been there.
Now, two original panel members of the government's child abuse inquiry. This is the one that's just being run now by Alexis Jay. I think she's the third or fourth chair. Mm-hmm. She's the one that found no police and no social workers were guilty up in Rotherham, if you remember her. Mm. So they've obviously brought her in to control this inquiry. Two panel members of the government's child abuse inquiry have said they were forced to fight attempts at political control interference from the Home Office when it was run by Theresa May. The pair said they wanted to speak out to warn potential members of supposedly independent teams being assembled at the orders of the Prime Minister to investigate Grenfell Tower fire. Sharon Evans and Graham Wilmer revealed how government officials intervened with the independent panel members by preparing a 23-page document instructing them how to answer questions from MPs. Now, these sorts of inquiries, like this child sex abuse inquiry, which we've now heard that various groups say is not fit for purpose, it's been going on for several years. It was started by Theresa May, and they were I remember seeing a few months ago that they still hadn't heard any evidence, which is quite incredible. It doesn't seem as if they're going to get to the bottom of this, does it?
Well, British inquiries are not regarded internationally as free, fair and independent. And the Pat Finucan Centre, based in Northern Ireland, but named after Pat Finucan, who was assassinated by loyalist paramilitaries working with the British state forces, have always called for a full inquiry into collusion between the security forces and the loyalist paramilitary murder campaign over decades. But they don't want a British inquiry because British inquiries are just not independent. But what inquiries are for in Britain is to kick something into the long grass. And at one stage, of course, Kinkora wasn't going to be included in the investigation of sex, child sex abuse in Britain on the grounds, which I find rather amusing, that it wasn't part of British jurisdiction, which is exactly what the conflict's been about for years and years and years, whether it is or isn't part of British jurisdiction.
So are they right? It's not fit for purpose, this child sex abuse inquiry?
I think the same is true of the Grenfell Tower inquiry. These are British inquiries, which are controlled by the executive rather than by the judiciary.
So what we're implying here is that even the Kinkora people behind that, the criminals behind that, and plenty of other, basically kids who were taken into care and then just farmed out to paedophiles, that they won't be brought to justice. That worries me. And also this week we hear that there's a great enthusiasm for unaccompanied minors at Calais to be given help to come to Britain and go to children's homes here.
Well, I mean, that's another story and another issue. I think that the child...
Well, I mean, have we got a safe environment for children to be taken into care homes in Britain at the moment?
I think the majority of people working in care homes are the genuine people who are doing a genuine job and trying to help. But the fact is, as Kinkora shows, the intelligence services abuse and manipulate young people as part of their psychological warfare techniques, and it's been going on for years. And will there be a full inquiry into all of this? I very much doubt it. Ultimately, what you're probably going to have in Northern Ireland is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where if people come forward and say what they were involved in, then they're not subject to prosecution.
But what I'm saying is it the right time for Theresa May, as she's done, to announce UK will accept more child refugees who are unaccompanied from Calais? It just seems to me that we need to get our house in order before we do that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter, if you've got child refugees at Calais who are under the age of 16 and nobody to help them, then something's going to have to be done about that, whatever.
Maybe the French, this isn't just kicking the blame over to France, but it might be that the French care system is more appropriate than the British care
system.
Well,
I suspect that what's going on is intelligence services, Western intelligence services, NATO intelligence services have been doing this all along, and not just in Northern Ireland.
But it's not just them, surely. Paedophiles too, ordinary paedophiles.
Well, yes, but the real problem with the VIP paedophilia is that in actual fact it's the use of paedophilia as a tool of psychological warfare. There's always been a problem with paedophilia in the Catholic Church, in Boy Scouts, whatever. But the use of paedophilia as a political tool by the intelligence services is truly sinister.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to this interview with Paul Williams, former CIA agent, who spoke to Sean Stone on Watching the Hawks, RT America, about the Gulen movement, who was supposedly behind the coup attempt, 18 months ago in Turkey.
The CIA was funding this operation. Not only this operation, and that explains it, why they could persist day after day, night after night, training these people to become jihadis and to fight over there.
Right.
Without taking action against them. Because the FBI, no, and I worked for the FBI for years, mm-hmm. did anything about it.
But so when you broke this story in this Lemberg, and obviously you said 35 other camps, training camps for militants that are going on here, you know, when you would approach, let's say, for the official story from FBI or CIA, what story would they give you as to why these camps were allowed to operate without being raided?
They couldn't explain it. There was absolutely no explanation. And once again, I had contacts in the FBI. I worked for the FBI. I was paid by the FBI for 10 years. Now, the second thing I found when I started looking into a guy by the name of Fethullah Gulen. Now, you and I are very much interested in Gladio, and you know how strategic Gulen is to the entire Gladio, too. Gulen has a compound in Sellersburg, Pennsylvania, less than an hour from where we're sitting. About 40 minutes from my house. Well, I went up there as well. At his compound in Sellersburg, it was very similar to what was going on in Islamburg. They were training, doing paramilitary training. They were armed to the teeth. They were all coming in from Turkey. The neighbors had complained, and nothing was done. Mm-hmm. Nothing was ever done. They talked to the neighbors were complaining about the helicopters flying around their properties for surveillance night and day. They complained about the explosions going on in the property, the sound of gunfire and of AK-47s. Nothing was done. So then I discovered, now this was really, really, really what dropped the scales from my eyes. Gulen, when he applied for his permanent residency in the United States, he was thrown out of Turkey, as you know, for trying to overthrow the Turkish government. This is going back to 1998. He was thrown out of Turkey, and just like Jilani, he's transported. This is the guy called the most radical, most dangerous Muslim in the world, transported from Turkey to Washington, D.C. originally, on a CIA transport. I discovered that, and I figured, this is insane. Mm-hmm. This is insane. And the next thing I found out is the camp that he had at Sellersburg was once again backed by the CIA. And his movement, his Islamic schools throughout the country, throughout the world, as you know, mm-hmm. and in all the schools in Central Asia are CIA agents.
So that's Paul Williams there speaking to Sean Stone, Martin.
Yeah, and I think Gladio 2, which you mentioned there, people can do a web search to look into that. Sybil Edmonds, who used to work for the FBI and is of Turkish origin, she's written quite extensively about Gladio 2. And people need to realise that Western intelligence services, for years, have been running and orchestrating Islamist terrorism.
The big question, of course, is Gladio 2 operating now in Britain?
Absolutely. I think there's no doubt about it. This is what's going on. British Special Forces have been in Syria, probably still are in Syria, working with al-Qaeda. And it's not something that used to happen and we stopped doing it. We're still doing it.
The police have told us that there are hundreds of these jihadis, apparently from Syria, that have come back to Britain now, but none of them has been interviewed at the airport.
Well, that's because they were probably recruited in the first place by Western intelligence services, who then used the Turks, Turkey and Jordan as places where they could be infiltrated into Syria. And I don't think anybody who's looked into this can dispute that the Western intelligence services working with the Saudis are behind jihadi terrorism, both in Syria and elsewhere.
Okay,
that's certainly the view of the Iranian, Russian and Chinese general staff.
And also there's all this government report into these training camps here in Britain, not training camps, schools in Britain educating people in Wahhabism, which was suppressed. But anyway, finally, the House of Saud. Have you managed to watch any of those yet?
No.
On Wednesday evenings, I said Fridays last, but it's on Wednesday evenings on BBC. It's been really actually quite powerful, very interesting, and a lot of Andrew Feinstein, who we had on this show, I think, 6 years ago, interviewing him about al-Yamamah and various other dodgy arms deals, which Tony Blair, your precious Tony Blair, stopped the inquiry into the corruption there.
Well, he's not my Tony Blair, Tony.
Well, he's in your party.
He's got the same name as you, Tony. I think that's much more important.
But he's the former leader of your party.
Well, of course, and if he is very much a puppet of bigger forces, and that's you know why he's not leading it anymore.
We'll have to watch the final one. I think it is next week, where they talk a bit more about MBS. But it does look as if they're saying, "Oh well, this corruption is over, going to be over with now. This new guy's arrived,"
which of course is just a whitewash. MBS is as evil as anything that's ever come out of the Saudi regime. And the Saudi regime are our close allies. Their chaps are all trained at Sandhurst. We have got British military personnel in Saudi Arabia now helping to force the biggest cholera epidemic in history on the poor people of Yemen. And we're doing that, and that's what our taxes get spent on, not helping the homeless on through to Bristol.
One very sad event this week was the death of Peter Wingard. I think it was one of the greatest actors at stage and screen. Fantastic. Also, we'll definitely have a clip of him next week, our final show, which starts at 5 and finishes at 7. And so that's time now to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7. Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi up next. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Secretary of Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance, Matthew Carey, and leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council, Eleanor Comley. And also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show, Dialects, on Tuesday. This show, though, the story links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk, where you'll find some details of how you can write to the station manager, Pat Hart, about whether you think that this show should start at 5 or 6. Anyway, you'll find me on Twitter in the meantime at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from Bill Withers. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away. I wonder this time where.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we'll hear updates on various grassroots activist issues, from climate liability and indigenous rights to the importance of whistleblowers and independent investigative journalism. We'll also discuss the overall state of the media. We're joined today by artist and writer Eleanor Goldfield of Act Out and ArtKillingApathy.com. We'll also be joined by journalist Kevin Gostola of Unauthorized Disclosure and ShadowProof.com. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are delighted to welcome back to the show Eleanor Goldfield. She's a creative activist, poet, singer, and writer. She's creator and host of the activist news show Act Out on Free Speech TV, also Occupy.com. And she is author, most recently, of a book, Paradigm Lost, Radical Verse and Visuals for the Shift. You can find her work at ArtKillingApathy.com. Eleanor Goldfield, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Eleanor, we had you on the program early December, late last year, and it was actually one of our most listened to shows, and so we're very delighted to have you back on, and apparently a lot of our listeners were happy to hear what you're doing, and so we have you back to give us an update. So remind people what you're doing and about your program and where they can learn more, and then let's talk about a few issues.
Basically, what I do is, you mentioned creative activism. So in terms of the show covers a wide range of topics, mostly things that the corporate media will never touch, which is a lot of things. And on top of that, we talk to people on the ground, be it creative activists, artists, singers, poets, visual artists, documentary filmmakers, but also people that just creatively think outside the confines of capitalism. So people who do urban gardening or people who do community programs or community outreach that are things that being a good pro does not teach you how to do. So people that are building and fighting simultaneously. So we have a lot of people on the show that bill, not just people in the United States, but also people from around the world. We've had people from northern Syria, from the Rojava revolution that's happening there, Egypt, Australia, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the show. And then outside of that, I do spoken word performances that blend spoken word along with projected visuals. And I try to go to a lot of these places that have frontline battles, such as pipeline resistance camps or places that are dealing with what it means to be at the short end of the capitalism stick. I guess that's it in a nutshell. And so, like, last time we talked about pipelines, which is something that I've worked a lot on, the prison industrial complex, the military industrial complex, all of these lovely complexes that sit under the larger umbrella of the capitalist system.
That's quite a list of things that you do. And of course, topics that we cover here at Project Censored, you noted that the corporate media don't really cover these issues in depth or in detail. And one of the issues that you mentioned was about pipelines. And I know that you and I had spoken earlier, and you were talking a little bit about the Enbridge pipeline and abuse of women and girls. That was a recent story that you're following.
The Enbridge Line 3 is the pipeline that's being proposed. Right now, it's on hold until June of 2018. I actually had some indigenous youth on my show late last year to talk about the indigenous resistance to this pipeline, because it'll be going through, of course, as usual, predominantly indigenous lands, and a lot of the rice fields in the area of Minnesota that are very important, not just, of course, for food and livelihoods, but also in terms of ceremonies and the sacred land for the indigenous people that live there. So that's kind of the main story that we hear on environmental blogs and in alternative media, but something that kind of gets lost in this shuffle and this fight against the pipelines is something called man camps. So basically, man camps are camps of transient workers that are basically just brought in to work on these fossil fuel projects. And they're predominantly transient workers who come in for a short amount of time, get paid a lot of money, and then leave. And for years, they've left in their wake not just a destroyed earth, but also sex trafficking and the drug trade and the rape and disappearance of an untold number of indigenous women. And one of the reasons that it's an untold number is because there isn't actually a comprehensive system for keeping track of the amount of indigenous women and girls who go missing or die or are raped. One of the reasons that this is because in terms of tribal sovereignty, these organizations are supposed to work together. It's supposed to be the tribal authorities, the federal authorities, and the local authorities, but they don't. It's a complete mess of bureaucracy, and a lot of this falls on the fact that the federal government has not given the tribal authorities access. For example, only in 2010, could tribal authorities even prosecute non-natives for domestic violence. And the majority of domestic violence cases were non-Native men assaulting Native women. And the tribal courts still can't prosecute rape or assault, only domestic violence cases and domestic assault. So the federal government has perpetually kept the indigenous and tribal lands away from accessing the tools and resources to properly prosecute and properly deal with this problem. A few tribes, and easily, 10 tribes or something, were supposed to be part of a program that was created under the Tribal Law and Order Act of 2010, I believe. The Tribal Access Program for National Crime Information back in 2010. 10 tribes were supposed to be a part of it. But, for example, the Tulalip tribe in 2015 announced that they had still not gotten access to the NCIC database, and even that they had offered to pay for it themselves. And this was part of a DOJ program that was supposed to try and streamline how tribal authorities and tribal communities could deal with these issues, predominantly, of course, surrounding indigenous women and girls. And there's still no comprehensive database. They still don't have access to this information, to national crime databases for these, again, predominantly non-Native men who come in here, come into the tribal lands, and destroy both people and planet, and then leave. And they know that there's no jurisdiction that will take care of them. Federal authorities do have the ability to prosecute rape, but they hardly ever do because it's just not a priority for them. So this is a really big issue, and it's something that a few groups and a few people have started to speak out against, but it's still a huge problem in these indigenous areas.
Well, Eleanor Goldfield, a remarkable and tragic story that we don't hear much of at all, surrounding the man camps, worker camps, the pipelines. Sounds like we have multiple issues going on here. Of course, we have the sort of a capitalist colonial or settler colonial kind of mentality, not only in terms of raping of the earth and fossil fuels, and then, of course, stacking on top of that the history of Western encroachment on indigenous lands. Now we're adding yet another patriarchal component of occupation of women and women's bodies. And now that we're living in our media-addled culture, we're subject to the Me Too campaign, which, of course, has unearthed so many important things on one level and sort of coming out. But there's also this infatuation in the corporate media of the gotcha whodunit celebrity status issue. Like, well, who's going to be the next one to fall? Rather than looking at the entire systemic patriarchal hegemonic culture itself. And here is a real deep-seated example in these man camps. And you mentioned that the DOJ isn't going about prosecuting a lot of these things that are happening. We know in Project Censored, we did stories on unprocessed rape kits. So just in that kind of a context, can you sort of riff through how these dots of oppression are connected?
Yeah, I mean, you make a really good point. I mean, the Me Too movement is seeing a lot of people being thrown out of their places of power, and rightfully so, for sexual assault and harassment. But the overarching majority, again, like the 99% of women and girls who have experienced this are not as important as, for example, a celebrity who experiences it. And even then, black and brown women experience this on a different level because you add the issues of racism and white supremacy and then, of course, indigenous women, the 500 years of colonial settlerism that still perpetuates to this day. I mean, Casey Camp Hornick, who is an incredible indigenous woman leader and has fought against a lot of dirty energy pipeline projects, said that they came with a smallpox blanket and now they come with bulldozers. So it's a sort of perpetuation of this colonial mentality that we can just come into these places and take whatever we want. And most of these workers are white men, so it's not really a big shift in the demographics either. And I think that this story in particular just shows again how not important these issues are, not only in terms of the women being hurt, but really placing that blame at the feet of the corporations who perpetuate it, because it's big oil. It's big oil and gas that are throwing these men into these man camps and just giving them money and saying, hey, do whatever you want. And I think in response to one of these complaints, one of the companies said, oh, we're going to do trainings, you know, about like sensitivity trainings or something like that.
What kind of training? Like, don't rape people?
It's probably more about like how to be a little more quiet about it so that people get off our case about this because it's making us look bad. That's really what the big corporations care about. They don't want anything that will interfere with their process of extraction, whether that be extracting resources from the earth or, you know, extracting something that they want from the women that they come into contact with. The corporations really care that they could do something about it, obviously, but they don't. And local authorities, again, because of this absolute mess of how these authorities work together, or rather don't work together, the men staying at the man camps, again, they know that they don't have anybody that's going to come down on them. It's not their boss that's going to come down on them. It's not any local or federal or tribal authority that's going to come down on them. So it's really, it's a free-for-all. And it's almost like going back to this idea of the Wild West, where the white men can just go and take whatever they want from these indigenous communities.
I was just thinking that, Eleanor Goldfield, and particularly in historical context, you go back to the Trail of Tears, or we go back however far we go with these forced relocations and colonialism in U.S. history or prior British colonial history, or many other European colonies, of course, by the way. But of course, in the more recent past, I couldn't help but recall Standing Rock, shooting water cannons at people in freezing cold weather, jamming cell signals so people couldn't communicate, yeah. Police coming from multiple states. I mean, this was just a full-on assault against these water protectors.
There were several comparisons made to what happened with the Bundy, I think, takeover of federal government land, and no shots are fired, no dogs are sicked on anyone, no tear gas, no water hoses in sub-zero temperatures. But people trying to protect their land that is not only protected under the fact that it's their sacred land, but it's also treaty land, well, no, they have to be shown a lesson because they're indigenous and they're standing in the way of white European patriarchal progress.
It's almost difficult to imagine that corporate media might cover these kinds of issues. I mean, they didn't cover Standing Rock for a long time. And then when they did, they had certain spin or angles on it. And certainly the case you're talking about, the man camps. Have you seen any significant coverage of this outside of maybe some of the local areas?
Not at all. There's no larger conversations about this. And I'm sure that the argument would be, well, that's local news. Well, this isn't just happening in that area in Minnesota. This isn't a problem that has happened all over the places that are dealing with the Bakken oil fields, which includes the Keystone, DAPL, the upcoming Line 3, which hopefully doesn't get the okay. But this has been a problem around that area for a long time. So this is nothing new, and people could easily, I mean, media could easily have gone in and gotten the story from the ground there, but it's not a point of interest. Because again, you know, as you and Project Censored do a great job of exposing, the people who pay the bills of corporate media are the same people that are drilling and fracking. So they're not interested, even things like NPR, National Petroleum Radio, they're not interested in shining a light on these issues because these are their meal tickets are coming from these same corporations.
Right. And of course, that kind of analysis, sort of a critical media literate analysis, looks at the propaganda model, ownership, advertising, reliance on sourcing. Another one of the things that we do at Project Censored, while highlighting a lot of great intrepid independent journalists, including the work that you do, we're trying to teach people how to read through the news and see behind the headlines so that people can be empowered to ask their own critical questions and turn off corporate news media and really turn on truly independent free press work. And again, there's really a lot of it. It kind of strains the imagination at times when we say, like, well, gee, there's an awful lot of time to be covering Donald Trump's latest inane tweet. But if these folks at these newsrooms would only just pick up a copy of a Project Censored book or go online to the many different blogs and independent sources and podcasts and shows like yours as well, Act Out, there's plenty of stuff to cover. And it's not that these people don't know that there isn't. It's just the structural system of journalism has just been completely co-op. And as you said, it's the same people that are drilling that are paying the bills and profits over in big media. And that's a major part of the problem.
I try to think of it like from the perspective of an organizer, because that's something that I do as well. Mm-hmm. And I basically think of it from the perspective of, is this story going to help the people that it's about? Is this story going to help get the truth out about an issue that's important that people need to know about or not? And if it's not, then why am I covering it? And it's the same thing with like the Trump thing that you mentioned. That's not helping anybody. That's not going to help anybody that doesn't have health care, that is struggling with sexual assault, that is struggling with poverty. It's not going to help anybody if I cover that. So why? Plus the fact, of course, as you mentioned, everybody else is covering it too. There's no new angle to cover. I did want to correct myself. The allowing tribal courts jurisdiction over a limited number of domestic violence and dating violence cases, that advancement came in 2015, 2 years after they reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act. That was one of the new pieces of legislation in there. But again, that does not allow the tribal courts to prosecute non-natives for rape or assault.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Right now, we're speaking with writer, artist, poet, Eleanor Goldfield, host of Act Out on Free Speech TV. And after this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are joined by Eleanor Goldfield. She's a creative activist, a poet, a singer, and a writer. Her recent book is titled Paradigm Lost, Radical Verse and Visuals for the Shift, with a foreword by Lee Camp and a whole host of artists and contributors in there, including, of course, Eleanor Goldfield herself. Her show is called Act Out. You can see that on Free Speech TV and Occupy.com, and you can learn more about her work at ArtKillingApathy.com. Eleanor Goldfield, just before the break, we were talking about a host of interconnected issues, including pipelines, guns and fossil fuels, man camps, rape culture, Me Too, Trump's tweets, were all these things kind of people maybe saying, wow, there is a strange connectivity between what's going on around here and what corporate media do and don't do. But I wanted to flip a little bit, and instead of only focusing on, hey, look at these really horrible things that are going on that the corporate media ignore, there's also some really interesting things, positive things, good things that have been happening the last couple of years around some of these issues, certainly with climate change, sort of moving off of fossil fuels. One of those stories, actually, we covered in the Censored 2018 book, and that was how there are young plaintiffs now that are invoking constitutional grounds for climate protection, and about how young people and millennials were looking at suing, filing lawsuits against the federal government and fossil fuel industry in U.S. federal court. This is something that I know you were also following. And quite recently in New York, we found news that the city is planning to sue 5 oil companies for climate change damages. Could you talk a little bit about that, Eleanor Goldfield?
The issue of climate liability is one that is popping up more so in the news now, but it's one that's actually been happening around the world for quite some time. And that is kind of what Bill de Blasio did January 10th, I believe it was. He issued a statement saying that not only was New York going to divest the $5 billion it had in over 190 fossil fuel companies in the next 5 years, but that also along with that, that he was going to sue the 5 largest oil companies for knowing about climate change, perpetuating it, and then doing nothing to protect the people and the cities that are suffering the greatest from it. And, of course, New York, after Hurricane Sandy, suffered $19 billion in damages, which is interesting enough what the city is now asking for in order to bolster the city for upcoming and ongoing storms that they will doubtlessly have to deal with. So the idea behind this is that, yes, of course, the fossil fuel companies have known for a long time the issue of Exxon knowing about climate change way back in the 80s and then deciding to cover it up because it just didn't fall in line with their profit margins. They have their own research departments. They know, as you see a lot of fossil fuel companies, even now, they're starting to shift to green energy as well, not because they care, but because it's more economically feasible. So they're going to start shifting, again, not because they care about people and planet, but because it makes more sense for the profit margins. But this step by de Blasio is an important step because New York is the largest city to do this. And I believe that Sacramento and Oakland also announced that they were divesting from fossil fuels. And Seattle divested from Wells Fargo, which happened around the same time that the DAPL was going through. And Wells Fargo was a big financial bolster for the Dakota Access Pipeline. So we see these sort of divestment movements and climate liability movements happening, and on a lot of different scales as well. For example, the Juliana versus the United States was a climate lawsuit that was brought in 2015. And basically, the complaint was that through the government's actions that caused climate change, they're violating the youngest generation's constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property, as well as a failure to protect the public trust resources. There's actually a court date coming up on February 5th as well for this. And so this issue of climate liability is one that's happening more and more. Of course, New York is just on a much larger scale. And New York City actually bringing in a lawsuit against 5 oil companies is great and hopefully sets the stage for more of the same.
Right. And we do see San Francisco, Oakland, Santa Cruz, and California doing this. Again, we mentioned earlier Exxon and Shell. That also includes Chevron that has a home here in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's a classic example, in fact, of environmental racism, where they have the highly polluting refinery in minority-dominant Richmond, California, north of Berkeley. And they have their offices over in the suburbs of San Ramon. But this is a fantastic development in terms of a global social justice kind of story. It's also story number 17 in Censored 2018. That story actually made the top 25 in our book last year. So it's very good to see an update and good to hear that there's still more momentum taking place around this issue. Eleanor Goldfield, let's shift to one other topic. Of course, the media. We were sort of riffing a little bit on the media earlier, mentioning sort of the focus on the Trump tweets and the slight focus or shift in the Me Too movement away from women and victims and sort of looking at a gotcha celebrity issue. One of the other things, and we can't say on air, one of the president's recent tweets, and we won't spend a lot of time on this, not a tweet, but a comment that he's now denying, referring to countries and immigration, but that's a sort of a segue into this conversation a little bit about immigration and what's going on with DACA, Dreamers. Right now, we're seeing wholesale ICE raids across the U.S., raiding, of all things, raiding 7-Eleven stores and so forth. And all that kind of stuff comes on the heels of this comment the president made about not great countries and slurred a lot of countries, Haiti, El Salvador, African countries. And again, one with any kind of historical knowledge or context here could say that a lot of these places that you're mentioning have been ravaged by Western colonialism and by corporate capitalism. And a lot of people come to the United States from these countries in the wake of the disaster that is oft left there. Anything you want to chime in about those ongoing issues?
I think it's important to note that our particular brand of imperialism, or, you know, freedom crusades, as we like to say, bringing freedom all over the world, has created these type of countries that produce refugees. And no, we haven't taken our freedom crusades to Norway. So that's one of the reasons that Norway has free health care, free education, paternity and maternity leave. The people whose countries we are destroying are actively trying to get over here. I mean, just thinking about, you know, you mentioned El Salvador. Well, guess who has a history there? This school is the Americas. So these countries that we systematically destroy, that we try to take down from the inside, whether it be staging a coup, whether it be economic sanctions, whether it be the School of the Americas and that particular brand of terrorism, whatever the case may be, we destroy these countries and then blame the people that are trying to flee and search for safety. That, of course, as you mentioned, is what's underlying the issue with that commenter, but that's not brought up by the mainstream of the corporate media. It's stuff that, you know, things like Project Censored bring up, and alternative media. These are the underlying issues that people need to understand, because people don't come to this country because things are going great where they are. That's why you don't have Norwegians. People actively come to this country because things are going horribly there. And if you look at, we have 1,000 bases all over the world. And guess what? Just in the past decade, our work with AFRICOM in Africa has perpetuated and contributed to so much turmoil there that, yeah, you're going to see an influx of refugees from that area, too. I mean, if you look at it, it's not that difficult to connect the dots to migration refugees coming to this country and our imperialistic, war hawkish policies in these countries. It's actually a pretty easy exercise.
And, of course, we've written about AFRICOM for years at the project. And, of course, Nick Pearce, one of our top stories from the last couple of years, about 1,000 military bases, special ops going on. I mean, you know, the U.S. is in, you know, three quarters of the world, basically, or more, with these kinds of special ops and ongoing things. But, you know, all of the things that we're talking about, Eleanor Goldfield, could be the things that are talked about instead of one of the FCC banned words dating back to the George Carlin days, right? Blank hole countries, right? We're not allowed to say this because of the FCC, but apparently I was talking to our producer Dennis before the show, and he was saying that on CNN the other day, he saw them just throwing down the word willy-nilly, like it was almost some kind of party that they could now say this word because the president said it. And certainly we've seen some great guerrilla artwork at projecting these things on his hotels and so on. That's schadenfreude moments. But let's again remember that these are the things that take up massive amounts of media airtime and column space instead of any of the things that we were just discussing and what you were just talking about in terms of migration, immigration, and foreign policy.
Yeah, exactly. And I think people call me, you know, a humbug and, oh, you're so depressing. You just want to pay attention to the depressing stuff all the time. And I said, no, I don't. I think it's great that people are projecting, you know, that message onto Trump Hotel. I think that's brilliant. But by perpetuating these sort of shallow messages and also by giving Trump that stage, I think this is also the bigger problem, is that we're giving him so much attention by focusing on this. Not that you should ignore his ability to do harm, but by focusing on these sort of shallow messages, you're bringing yourself down to that level, basically. You know, there's talk about, like, you know, what should people do for the State of the Union? Oh, we should do a live rebuttal. No, don't. don't respond to that. Like, if a kid's throwing a temper tantrum, you don't get down on the floor and go, oogie, boogie, boogie. You're like, okay, you need to stop. And then, you know, when you're done having a fit, then we can figure this out.
You don't feed the tantrum behavior. But you notice that Trump is getting what he wants. He's getting nonstop coverage. He's getting more and more attention for these utterly absurd statements. And the media, they buy right into it, hook, line, and sinker, the corporate media. And meanwhile, they still are not covering key issues that matter. And even though, you know, what we saw at the Golden Globes not long ago, the solidarity movement, the Me Too movement, the moving speech from Oprah Winfrey. But all that we get out of that is Oprah for president. Then that runs out and spins in the ditch. And then we're also then not talking about the key issues once again. The corporate media, they can't seem to find the story, even if it's right in front of their faces.
Well, yeah, and of course, that's, as you and Project Censor pointed out, that's all by design. It's a lot better to sit and have a roundtable discussion as to whether Oprah Winfrey's dress means that she's good enough to be president or not. It's a lot better to sit and talk about that than to talk about, you know, what's going on in Haiti and how that is connected to the Clinton Foundation and what's going on, still going on in Puerto Rico, that's still going on in Flint. Like, these are stories that don't get high ratings. And, you know, part of that does fall on us, the public. And I think, you know, one of the things that I try to do is not just say, oh, bad media, because at the end of the day, we are consuming this. We are consuming this fluff. And we might complain about it over a beer, but unless we are actually looking at it and saying, you know what, I'm not going to consume that anymore. I'm not going to play into that tantrum, it'll continue. So I think a lot of this falls on our shoulders, not just as journalists, of course, but as citizens, to actively say that we're not going to be a part of this. We are going to be part of the movement that fights this sort of thing and that builds an alternative instead, and to throw our energy and our attention behind alternative media and the people that are actually doing real work and the people that actually need our help, and so that we don't pay attention to the fluff and the shallow nonsense.
Absolutely. And again, Eleanor Goldfield, there are so many people doing great journalistic and free press work, and so many young people. And particularly another thing that we don't see much of, we don't see a lot of focus, even in progressive movements and in left movements. We don't see enough of the focus on young women and people of color that are on the front lines telling these stories and doing this work. And, you know, Project Censored, in addition to lauding and highlighting the good work that people like you and others are doing, we're also really interested in teaching critical media literacy as a serious public educational program. So, as you said, people can turn off corporate media and they can begin finding these alternatives that do exist, and other stories and narratives are being told. So, Eleanor Goldfield, thank you so much again for joining us on the Project Censored show.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for all that you and Project Censored do. It's such important work.
And you can learn more about Eleanor Goldfield at artkillingapathy.com. Up next on the program, we'll turn our attention to another independent journalist. That would be Kevin Gostola. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we're going to interview independent journalist Kevin Gostola. Kevin Gostola is the co-host of Unauthorized Disclosure with Rania Kallek. He is managing editor of Shadowproof.com. He was previously a staff columnist and reporter for FireDogLake.com. Kevin's work has appeared in The Guardian, The Nation, Salon, Alternate, and Common Dreams, and he's appeared on Democracy Now!, Counterspin, The Young Turks, Uprising, The Majority Report, and Huffington Post Live. He has also been featured in several Project Censored works, including most recently Censored 2018, highlighting his work with Unauthorized Disclosure. And several years ago, Kevin Gostola had the number one censored story with his coverage of the Chelsea Manning trial. Kevin Gostola, welcome to the Project Censored show.
Thank you.
So, Kevin, let's just reintroduce your important work to the Project Censored audience. I'm pretty sure that our listeners know your work, especially because of the journalism you've done around whistleblowers and whistleblowing. But feel free to tell our listeners about some of the work you're doing both at Shadowproof, but also with Rania Kallek at Unauthorized Disclosure, and where people can find out more.
So to start off, the work around Chelsea Manning continues. Currently, I'm looking at the upcoming reality winner trial that should be happening this year at some point. And there's a lot of issues to get into with that and ways in which her case compares to Chelsea Manning that I see as a continuation of my work. And like you mentioned, a piece in the most recent book from Project Censored, that your annual book, I contributed along with my co-host, Rania Kalik, who is currently based in Lebanon. She and I wrote about our podcast and what we're doing and building a space where we can include more dissenting voices in media, but also expand the spectrum debate. It's not just about finding new voices, but also finding ways in which we can have conversations that are beyond what is okay and acceptable on Twitter, beyond what is okay and acceptable on your Facebook page, beyond what's acceptable in the establishment or corporate media outlet.
And your partner in crime at Unauthorized Disclosure, Rania Kalik, we certainly would love to have Rania on a future program, but you know, her work in the Middle East, Syria, Libya, she writes about a great many of these issues and often is seen as controversial, again, because of her commitment to try to tell the stories that aren't being heard. Of course, these are stories being pulled from people in some of these war-torn regions, but it's very difficult oftentimes to sort out some of the confusion and the mess. And certainly we know that Rania has contributed trying to straighten out some of those narratives. And again, listeners can check out your podcast, Unauthorized Disclosure. I think if they just search for it online, they can find Unauthorized Disclosure as a podcast in iTunes. Is that correct, Kevin?
Yeah, that's correct. And also, if you do Google it, you'll get episodes that are posted on Shadowproof.
And that's shadowproof.com. Tell us a little bit about your history there, because you were with Fire Dog Lake, and you are now part of Shadowproof, which has been around for a little while now. But tell our listeners, what's Shadowproof about?
Shadowproof was the organization that I started with my colleague, Brian Sonnenstein. We founded it together. He focuses on prisons, the prison industrial complex, private prisons, and then I regularly post stuff about whistleblowing and all kinds of other stuff. And what we wanted to do is to have a news organization that not only could cover the kinds of work, do the kinds of stories that we were doing at Fire Dog Lake, but also have a way in which we could support and make relationships with freelancers who might be having an exceptionally difficult time finding places for their work. And since we're a media organization that's not really built around personality, we don't have like a billionaire funding us. We don't have anything of that nature going on. We figure that our budget, the way we want to focus it and the way that we want to get as much mileage as we can out of our work is to look to these writers that are maybe doing critical work, doing exceptional jobs, but they're struggling when they contribute their work to get it accepted, or after it's accepted, they're having trouble getting paid for their work, or they're having issues where the editor's just sitting on their piece and that 2 months have gone by and they don't know when it's going to be published. And so we figure that we've got a pretty good track record so far of working with freelance journalists and starting to grow support. We're aspiring to build the ideal media organization. And we don't claim that we're going to be the best organization or the only organization you read, but we're just trying to struggle through those issues that are really prevalent among independent media right now in terms of trying to last and fund your website and pay people well. And if we can solve some of those issues. And our site uses a membership model where people donate monthly, but they become members. And we really like that model as a way to sustain our journalism.
Interestingly enough, Kevin Gastola, that's the model that we use at Project Censored, Media Freedom Foundation. And also our purpose is to really try to get these great independent journalistic stories and sources and outlets out there to the public so more and more people can turn off corporate media and turn in to this really solid investigative reporting. And that's what you do at Shadowproof. shadowproof.com. And again, if our listeners are not familiar, you can check out Kevin Gostola's work at shadowproof.com. And right now on your webpage, you've got a story on movement against prison slavery, a review on the film The Post. You have a piece on taxation is theft. You have some of your interviews here. You have a great protest song of the week with David Rovics, the great folk singer that we've worked with at Project Censored. So again, Shadowproof is a stellar source. It's grown in the last several years, and I encourage listeners to check that out. So Kevin Gostola, let's get into some of the specifics, especially some of the reporting, at least, that I know you so well for, and that's your reporting on whistleblowers. Maybe we should go back to Chelsea Manning. You covered it more than, I think, almost anybody at the time that this was going on. And of course, Chelsea Manning, after being released from prison at the very end of the Obama administration, Chelsea Manning has now announced a run for the Senate in Maryland. So that's a pretty fascinating kind of bookended story there. Can you tell us a little bit about that, or some of the highlights of your reporting on the Manning case and why it's still significant?
The fact that Chelsea Manning is running for the Senate has put Democrats in a very, I think, difficult position. There are quite a few that have remained silent, but she's planning to run against Senator Ben Cardin, who is a establishment senator who's been in office since 2006. And I have a piece that is up at shadowproof.com that people should go read. After they hear this interview, they'll be able to go find it. And one of the things that I find crucial to understanding the reaction is that people think Ben Cardin is probably good enough, that it's just okay for them to have Ben Cardin in as a Democrat. And I think they're very concerned that Chelsea Manning, being the kind of a person she is, who has attracted a lot of attention, and you know, she's going to be raising money, and there's a bit of a celebrity to Chelsea Manning, and I'm not saying that negatively necessarily, but she's able to garner a lot of attention. And she will be putting Democrats in this position where they actually have to defend having Ben Cardin as their senator. And I don't think they like them. They especially don't like that they're going to have to do it against someone who was convicted of felonies for releasing classified information to the public. You know, they're looking at her and they're seeing that there's a perception among the Republican Party and conservatives that she's seen as a traitor. And I think they're very concerned that she's going to run an insurgent, left-leaning campaign against Ben Cardin that they're going to have to actually acknowledge, and it's going to cause them some division and then maybe make them vulnerable to a Republican. And I don't know that any of those concerns are even legitimate, but I just raise them because I think that's why you're going to see feverish claims from people. Like, one of the people I cite in my piece is Zach Petkanis, who was part of the rapid response team for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. And the first thing that came out of Zach's Twitter account when this news was announced was a suggestion that she had given information to a Russian intelligence outfit,
Russiagate, yes.
WikiLeaks. Yeah. And so people needed to be concerned about that. Now, mind you, he was notified immediately by someone that this was 2010. And even if you believe that WikiLeaks has somehow had some kind of interference or collusion or whatever that might be, we're talking 2010. At that point, nobody made any suggestions of the kind. Now, he came back and said that in 2012, Julian Assange went to do a show for Russia Today. And he believes that although that's the only time they were publicly connected, that there must be some kind of grand conspiracy going on that went all the way back to 2010. And somehow Manning is a dupe and she was involved in it back as early as that. But this, they don't have to have any substance to their conspiracy because the effect will just be to demonize. And they've already made the suggestion that she's running against Ben Cardin because he was involved in some kind of report that really advanced or upped the ante as far as their claims about Russian interference in the Trump administration. And so they're very concerned about her as a candidate.
This from a group of people that are quick to wield the conspiracy theorist weaponized kind of term against those with whom they disagree, much like Donald Trump weaponized the term fake news. But again, a lot of what's going on in the so-called Russia collusion story, it is not of great substance that we've seen in the reporting. And it's another example of how they're wielding this against not just Manning going back to 2010, but also through RT. I recall when one of the reports came out last year that these folks were actually so reaching that they were saying that Abby Martin's program on Russia Today, Breaking the Set, which had been off the air for a couple of years before the election, somehow was the useful idiot and working to cost Hillary Clinton the election. You might recall that.
Well, there's a commonality here. Zach also was front and center when Jill Stein was having to provide documents to
right.
the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and screaming that she was a Russian agent, although there wasn't any proof of that at all. And that's something to consider. And then the other thing I think that's worth considering is the identity aspect, because she's
Indeed.
Transgender and she's going to potentially be vying for that first seat in the Senate as a transgender senator. You know, if she would gain some kind of traction, I really believe that the LGBT community would be in a panic because they wouldn't want the first transgender senator of the United States to be Chelsea Manning, because they were very silent and reserved when her case was unfolding. And very few groups or anybody involved in the LGBT establishment said anything positive about her.
And of course, it's going to be ongoing because Manning has announced a run for Senate in Maryland. But I'm afraid you're correct, Kevin Gustola, that we're going to continue to see these kinds of smears and attacks. Mind you, Manning was sentenced, and none of the people that she outed have seen any kind of justice. There's no cases going to court from the infamous video, the collateral damage video, right? Or the collateral murder video, as it was called, was one of the things that Manning released that clearly shows war crimes, U.S. troops laughing as they shot innocent civilians, journalists, others. Nobody's been brought to justice for this.
Oh, absolutely. And Chelsea called it war porn, I believe, when she was giving her statement. And everything that was revealed there, no one, absolutely no one, has been brought before a court for any torture. She had evidence of assassination squads in these reports. There's nothing around that. You had misconduct among diplomats. You had things with people who were spying on different countries that were supposedly friendly with, and to my knowledge, those people never were fired. There's very little repercussions for anybody as far as the disclosures from Manning go, but of course she was given a 35-year sentence, and even though the movement that supported her managed to convince President Obama to commute the sentence, and she was given some mercy in that respect.
Yeah, not pardon, but commute.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, even though that's the case, she still received a sentence that's actually longer than people receive for, in some cases, really violent crimes like murder, or even in some cases, you know, people who actually do spy as an agent of a foreign power. You know, they've actually had shorter sentences than Manning, who was clearly a whistleblower.
Well, Kevin Gustola, we know you'll continue to be covering what's going on and a piece online at shadowproof.com about the Manning candidacy. I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're speaking with journalist Kevin Gustola of shadowproof.com, also the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast with Rania Kallak. We'll continue our conversation with Kevin Gustola after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We continue now our conversation with journalist Kevin Gostola of Unauthorized Disclosure, the podcast with Rania Kalik, a piece included in Censored 2018, highlighting the work of Kevin and Rania. Also, Kevin Gostola writes with Shadowproof.com. You can learn more about the work online there. And Kevin, before the break, we were talking about Chelsea Manning and your coverage of her trial and upcoming now Senate race. But you've covered a lot of whistleblowers, including John Curiaco, the CIA torture case, and how he went to prison. Basically, again, another example of somebody that blows the whistle is imprisoned for blowing the whistle, and none of the people that were outed for breaking other laws ever see any real justice. You're also covering another case, the case of Reality Winner. Could you remind our listeners what's going on with the Reality Winner case? I know you had mentioned a little bit earlier about an upcoming trial, but could you summarize what's happening with this case?
Just to be sure that everyone knows who we're talking about, Reality Winner is a former NSA contractor who's in jail in Georgia right now. And what she did is disclose a top secret, it was marked top secret, report that contained intelligence that the NSA had collected related to potential Russian interference or hacking of the election infrastructure around the 2016 election. And she looked at this document, and according to the interrogation transcript between her and FBI agents, she said that she thought this document should have been public, or at least the contents of it should have been part of the conversation. There was all these daily news reports about Russia and all of these allegations, and she thought if what I'm reading here is true, we definitely should be talking about the vulnerability of our election infrastructure. So this document was allegedly passed to The Intercept and published. And then when The Intercept ran this report, it wasn't long after that we learned she was arrested and she was going to be charged with violating the Espionage Act, which is the law from World War One era that's been used as like a sledgehammer to basically go after anyone who releases information that they think is in the public interest. And so in her case, what's going on that's most critical right now to follow, I think we need to be mindful that the media isn't covering her case closely and giving us daily updates, even when there are important developments happening. And in particular, I would call people's attention to the fact that she's trying to have the statements during her FBI interrogation suppressed because she was not Mirandized. They never read her rights. The agents and a few others, and they were all armed, she says, came in to her home. They were searching her house. They did have a search warrant, but she was there and she couldn't leave. And they wouldn't tell her if she was going to be arrested, but they were definitely detaining her at that point. And they put her in a position where she ended up incriminating herself, and they never read her rights. They never asked her if she wanted to have a lawyer present for the interrogation. And so she's challenging that in court. And I think this is different because compared to Chelsea Manning's case, when I look at this, it's hard to talk about Reality Winner in the same way as Chelsea Manning, because Chelsea Manning was someone who took responsibility for the release of the information. But I believe Reality Winner sees herself as a whistleblower, but it's a tricky situation where in court, it seems like they're not admitting yet that she actually released this document because they want to have those statements suppressed so that it'll be harder for the government to prosecute her. So it creates a little bit of gymnastics on the part of me as a journalist discussing her case.
Well, indeed. And of course, listeners can learn more at shadowproof.com because you have a piece discussing this on the website. And I assume that you're going to be covering this more, given that there's an upcoming trial and I believe the date of which you mentioned had been moved.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be moved. But definitely for people who are interested in having in-depth coverage, and if they want the kind of in-depth coverage that I did of Manning, I'm planning to travel to Augusta for the trial when it happens and be there to have the kind of reporting that contrasts with you know, the New York Times or the CNN, where, you know, the CNN guy might show up and fall asleep during the trial. So you might want to have somebody like me there so you can be sure you figure out what actually happened that day.
That's certainly what stood out in your reporting about Manning, and that's what caught our attention at Project Censored, and just the stories alone that you told around the Manning story. Just your story covering that trial was a story in and of itself, in addition to the Manning case, as a really damning account of corporate media and their lack of interest in covering seriously these types of issues. So, Kevin Gastola, we have a few minutes left in this segment. Again, your reporting about the Manning case was also a great indictment of corporate media because of how they had chosen to cover the case or not cover the case. So your story about the Manning trial is a story in and of itself, meaning in addition to what was going on with Manning. And so on that front, given that you yourself have also been a sharp critic of the shortcomings of corporate news media, you also recently wrote a review of a film that's out now called The Post, about the Washington Post and the Pentagon Papers. And a lot of folks interested in the history of that have seen the film, of course, might be surprised that the film doesn't focus on the whistleblower, Daniel Ellsberg, and in fact is a different kind of perspective, and certainly maybe doesn't go into as much detail about the CIA media connections and so on. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your thoughts of The Post, and do you see it as a propaganda piece?
I don't know if I see it as a propaganda piece, but I'll return to that, and I promise to address that. But first, my initial reaction to the movie was that I enjoyed it. I was very taken in by it because overall, it stands, and you know, I saw it with, you know, my wife, who doesn't follow this stuff closely, and she walked away excited and thinking, yes, media organizations should publish this. Stand up to the government. You shouldn't let the government dictate what appears in the newspaper. You should exercise your First Amendment rights and stand tall. And so I thought, more than anything, and I also think that optimistically, Daniel Ellsberg in the movie shows up as a positive figure. There isn't any attempt in the film to tear him down or really undermine what he's disclosing, even though he only appears in about 15 minutes of the film. But the thing that I found to be underwhelming about it was just that once you step away from the film, I always knew this story as a New York Times story. I mean, the New York Times is on this case before the Supreme Court. So right. I knew it from the perspective of the New York Times. I lay this out in my review where I always wondered why you're going to see it from the Washington Post perspective. And basically, I'm not trying to be misogynistic, but basically I've seen that the reason why they decided to do a whole movie that centered around Washington Post publisher Katherine Graham as the central figure of the Pentagon Papers story, or the central way to tell the Pentagon Papers story, was because she was a woman and because they were very interested in painting her as this brave, courageous person. And this is sort of, I think, just the way that Hollywood is thinking. And again, like it's sort of runs into the same pitfalls that people ran into in wholly supporting Hillary Clinton's campaign, unquestionably, without looking at her flaws as a Democratic politician. And so when I look at the film, I see that as part of why we're not just telling the story of Ellsberg, or why we're not just telling the story of the New York Times, is because they wanted a woman that they could follow as the central character. But in doing that, you have to deal with the fact that Katherine Graham, not to mention Ben Bradley, are both people who have connections to the CIA. You know, Graham is friends with Robert McNamara and is having social events and dinners with him on a regular basis. And now her paper is going to be in a position where they need to make a decision whether they're going to publish the Pentagon Vietnam study. And she's compromised. She's not someone who can really say yes or no to this because she's worried she's going to lose a friend. And so that's critical. But the one thing I'll point out quickly that I don't think everyone might get when they watch the film is that I saw this as a very clear cautionary tale against access journalism. And I know that's not the film that Steven Spielberg intended to create, but knowing what I know about media, if you watch it and pay attention to what's going on, it's really staggering how the Washington Post is so inept and incapable of engaging in investigative journalism that they really don't know how to compete with the New York Times and the fact that they're going to blow open the story. And if a couple things don't happen, if I believe that Ellsberg called them the Lavender Group or whatever, if they had come in and dumped documents on the table and gave them to one of the Post reporters, or if Ben Bagdikian had known that Ellsberg was the one who was releasing these documents, I don't know how they ever would have managed to hold court against the New York Times. Because at that point, they were concerned that they weren't getting access to Tricia Nixon's wedding.
You know, we could certainly bring that up to the present when both of those papers seem to have sunk to new depths with Bezos, Jeff Bezos, and the Washington Post and their CIA contracts. And the mighty Wurlitzer plays on, as Frank Weisner would say. But definitely, I encourage people to read your review, and you certainly bring up the CIA and Mockingbird and the mighty Wurlitzer. And again, certainly some juicy quotes from Graham, too, including in promotion of secrecy and allowing the elite newspapers to decide what the public maybe should or should not be allowed to see. Kevin Gostola, Shadowproof.com, and Unauthorized Disclosure. I wanted to thank you not only for your work, the important work you do, and the work you're doing with Rania Kallach as well, but thanks for taking time to join us on the Project Censored Show. We definitely will be having you back on the program later on this year. Thanks, Kevin Gostola.
Thank you.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. I'm also executive producer of the program with Peter Phillips. The Project Censored Show was founded in 2010. Our senior producer is Anthony Fest. Our producer from KPCA in Petaluma is Dennis Murphy. Our engineer is Erica Bridgman. To learn more, listen to past broadcasts, and to support Project Censored in this program, please visit us online at projectcensored.org. You can further support the program via Patreon or through our website. Please follow and like us on Facebook and Twitter at Project Censored. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The execution of Martin Luther King. More secrecy surrounds the murder of Martin Luther King than even that of the Kennedys. Most people still believe that James Earl Ray, who never even had a trial, was the lone assassin. Dr. William Pepper, who became Ray's lawyer, has uncovered evidence of the involvement of the Memphis Police Department, the U.S. government, and even the U.S. Army in a plot to kill one of the most influential leaders of the 20th century. His book, An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, represents a quarter century of detective and legal work. In a moving turn of circumstance and historic coincidence, Bill Pepper, who today is an author and acclaimed lawyer, is the same Bill Pepper who as a young man went to Vietnam as a reporter. He returned with photos of children burned by napalm that shocked the world. Martin Luther King saw these photos in Rampart's magazine in early 1967. Witnesses say that he wept as he looked at them. He asked to meet the young man who had taken them, and thus began a friendship between Martin Luther King and Bill Pepper and the King family. Bill Pepper spoke at a San Francisco bookstore in February of 2003. He takes us back to Riverside Church in New York, where he witnessed Martin Luther King's compassion with the victims in Vietnam in his first major anti-war speech. Here is the voice of Bill Pepper.
That passion came out in his speech on April 4, 67 at Riverside Church, where he said that his native land had become the greatest purveyor of violence on the face of the earth. Quoting Thoreau, he said, "We have come to a point where we use massively improved means to accomplish unimproved ends. And what we should be doing is focusing on not just the neighborhood that we have created, but making that worldwide neighborhood into a brotherhood." And we were going entirely in the opposite direction. And this was what he was pledging to fight against. We spoke very early in the morning following that Riverside address, and he said, "Now, you know, they're all going to turn against me. We're going to lose money. SCLC will lose all of its corporate contributions. All the major civil rights leaders are going to turn their back on me, and all the major media will start to tarnish and to taint and to attack me, and I will be called everything even up to and including a traitor." So he said, "We must persevere and build a new coalition that can be effective in this course of peace and justice." Well, that coalition came to be known as the National Conference for New Politics. It was an umbrella organization, and it held its first and last convention in Chicago over the Labor Day weekend of 1967. And it had 5,000 delegates, maybe the largest convention of people ever assembled in the history of this country at the Palmer House in Chicago. And they came from every walk of life, every socioeconomic class, every ethnic group. And the purpose was to form this coalition, umbrella coalition, that would effectively coordinate a massive third-party political campaign against the Johnson administration and Johnson's reelection, but at the same time develop grassroots organizing capabilities in the communities across America. Well, it wasn't to be, although it continued and struggled for a period of a year, but it wasn't to be because of government's wiliness and our naivete. We never appreciated the extent to which government would go to undermine and undercut that kind of movement. And they were responsible for the formation of the first Black Caucus. And that Black Caucus was largely led by agents provocateurs who came from the Blackstone Rangers, organizations of that sort in Chicago. And they corralled each delegate, each Black delegate who came in, and brought them into a room and formed this unity of all Black delegates. We thought this was healthy and there would be then this block that would be in the vote and introduce the concerns of the Black community across America. We didn't know that it was government-induced and government-sponsored and government-paid for, and that the leaders were gangsters. Blackstone Rangers would surface again and again in the course of the movement. So Martin delivered the keynote address at the convention, and as he was speaking, a note was passed over my shoulder to me, and I read it, and it said, "Get him out of here after he finishes his speech, or we will take him hostage and humiliate him before the world." They were so afraid that if this man stayed on for the substantive part of the convention, that he, as a unifier, might bridge the differences and might overcome the provocation that was designed to disrupt the convention. So we did get Martin out of the Palmer House very quickly after his speech and went on with the convention, and it was all downhill from there. They forced through resolutions that simply were so antagonistic to sections of the movement and engendered such hostility that all the money dried up for that noble cause. And they were successful. That being the case, we struggled and worked in that last year of his life. And I remember the last time I saw him alive, I think it was in late February, He had started to become involved already in the sanitation workers' strike. In his own mind, he thought that this was the basis for the encampment of the poor people in Washington, and this was a good launching pad. And he sympathized with all the goals of the sanitation workers in Memphis, and so the rest is history. He was assassinated on the 4th of April, 1968, 1 year to the day. It's interesting, from the time he delivered the Riverside speech. We went to the memorials, Spock and I, and the funeral, and then I walked away from political activity. I'd had my fill of it. And Ben and Julian Bond and others went up to see Bobby Kennedy, who had asked, invited us all to come. And I didn't know him in 68. I knew him, a much younger person, when I handled a campaign of his as a citizen's chairman in Westchester County, New York, when he ran for the Senate. And I didn't like him at all. I thought he was opportunistic, and all those things that you have heard about Bobby Kennedy I thought were true. And I saw them, confronted them directly. But the Bob Kennedy who was killed in 68, I think, was a very different person, and I regard it as one of my sadnesses that I did not see him at the end, because he had made an overture to Martin to run as a vice presidential candidate with him. It was not generally known, but when he announced, he made his announcement March, I guess it was 15th or 16th, he made contact with Martin. And I'm sure that contact was known. Now, 8-9 years later, Abernathy called me and asked me to go up to the prison with him. Actually, 10. It was late 77. He asked me to go to the prison with him and interrogate James Earl Ray. And I said, this is a funny request, Ralph. Well, 10 years after the fact, why would you want to do that? And do you have some questions about it? Isn't Ray guilty? I didn't know anything about the case. I didn't want to know about it at that point. And he said, I just have some questions. Will you come along with me? And I still don't fully understand why he did that. He said, but I want you to interrogate him, and I want to watch him when you do that. So I said, well, it's going to take me some while to get up to speed on this case because I don't know anything about it. So it did take some time. And in August of 78, finally, we went, and we went through this session of 5 hours intensive interrogation of James Earl Ray. His lawyer at the time was Mark Lane, was there. Body language specialist from Harvard, Howie Behrens, came, and he sat in a corner, just watched James's movements as I put him really through a rather rigorous, painful time. He was very different than we expected to find. He was shy, docile, soft-spoken, thoughtful, and not at all the kind of racist figure that had been depicted in the media. Not at all. He knew very little about weapons, very clearly had virtually no skill at all with them. He was a petty thief and burglar, hold-up man, but he was totally incompetent at that. He was known for showing up too late. Supermarkets, he wanted to stick up, and the time lock would already have been fixed on the safe. And the staff would say, look, there's nothing we can do about this. And he said, we'll give you our money. He said, I don't want your money. I don't want to rob working people. I want the money from this corporation, yeah, type of thing. And he had a virtually non-existent marksmanship score when he took a test in the Army, and he didn't know much about guns. When he was instructed to buy a weapon that became the throwdown gun in the assassination, he bought a 243 Winchester rather than a 30-06 that he was told to be. He didn't know the difference between them. And when he showed the weapon he had bought to Raoul, who was controlling him, he sent him back to exchange it, which is a matter of record. He went back and exchanged this one rifle for another the next day. And that's not something he thought of himself. It just was the wrong gun. The guy wanted a 30-06 caliber rifle, so they had a 30-06 rifle as the throwdown gun. And so that's why he had to go back and exchange it. Well, after the interview, we became convinced, Abernathy and I became convinced that he was not the shooter. Didn't know what other role he might have played, but it was clear he was not the assassin of Martin Luther King. This guy couldn't have done that. But he raised so many questions that I'd never heard raised before, that had never been answered, that I just decided I would begin to go into Memphis and talk to some people, become familiar with the terrain and the crime scene, and see if I could get some answers to those questions. And I did. And the more I began to probe around, the more concerned I got about new questions that were unanswered. And I'd hoped that the Select Committee on Assassinations would solve that problem, because they were in session at the time, and I hoped they would solve it. Well, their report came out in 1979, and they didn't solve it. All they did was to continue the official history of the state's case, which was that James Earl Ray was the lone assassin and that he was guilty. So I kept going back and forth, visiting him and asking him questions, and then going in off and on into Memphis, and then occasionally into New Orleans. And slowly things started to come together to the point where 10 years on in this process, I became convinced that not only was Ray not the shooter, but that he was an unknowing patsy. And it was at that point in 1988 that I agreed to represent him, so I became his lawyer, and I was his lawyer for the last 10 years of his life, trying very hard to get him a trial. He never had a trial. It's amazing that, of course, most people in the United States, if not the world, never understand that James Earl Ray never had a trial, that he was coerced into copying a guilty plea by Percy Foreman as his second lawyer. And people say, well, why would he plead guilty? Goodness me. Well, when you put that question to James, his answer was always the same. Look, he told me all kinds of things. I always wanted this trial. Right down to the end, I was trying to get this trial. But Percy said to me, you know, your dad's a parole violator. He's going to be sent back to jail 50 years after violating that parole. They'll make sure he's locked up. Your whole family will be harassed forever. They convicted you anyway because the media's got you wiped out as the killer. You haven't got a chance. They're going to fry you, Jamie. But the thing that really convinced him to get rid of Foreman by pleading was Percy's statement that, I'm not in good health, James. I cannot give you the best defense because I'm not in good health. And he said to me, that was it. When my lawyer said to me, I'm not in good health and I can't give you the best defense, that really started to worry me. So he said, what you should do, Foreman said, what you should do is plead guilty, then make a motion for a new trial, get a new lawyer, and you overturn the guilty plea, and then you're off and away. James said, but I don't have any money for a new lawyer. So Foreman said, well, don't worry about that, James. I'll give your brother Jerry $500. He can go hire you a new lawyer. But you got to make an agreement that you will not cause any problems at the guilty plea hearing. You'll just take that guilty plea. Well, Percy not only said that, he put it in writing. And we got a copy of Percy's letter to James, where he said, Dear James, I'm going to give this $500 to your brother, the condition that you plead guilty and you do not cause any undue disturbances at this guilty plea hearing. He actually put that in writing. Remarkable admission. So James certainly, he pled. He did cause a little problem at the guilty plea hearing, but nevertheless, he pled. And Jerry got the $500. And James didn't wait for the lawyer to be retained, but he filed himself, pro se, by himself, a petition for a new trial. He pled on March 10th. That was when he was guilty and convicted and sentenced to 99 years. And on March 13th, 3 days later, he filed. And from March 13th until the day that he died, James Earl Ray was trying to get a trial. Well, on March 31st, the judge who had sentenced him and who had overseen the guilty plea hearings was reviewing the petition for a new trial, had told some people that he was concerned about certain aspects of the case. Whether that's serious or not, one doesn't know. And he was found dead in his office with his head on James's motion papers of a heart attack. speculate what that means. It may mean nothing. It just may mean that man was under a lot of stress for a lot of different reasons, had a heart attack, and he happened to be reviewing those papers, and when he collapsed, the head went on. Those was James' papers. But there were two. There's a law in Tennessee that says if you if a judge dies and you make a motion for a new trial, in the course of that motion for ruling on it, the judge dies, you get a new trial automatically. There were two people who had filed those motion before Preston Battle. One was James Earl Ray, and the other person was the one who got the trial. James didn't, of course. So he went on all of those years trying to get that trial and was unsuccessful. Meanwhile, the state's case was articulated in a number of books by Gerald Frank, a chap called McMillan, eventually commentaries by David Garrow, and ultimately a fellow called Gerald Posner. They're always the same line, always the same story, unyieldingly lone assassin, no conspiracy, and no deviation at all. And that's been the case from beginning to the end. Well, I tried to get James a trial for many years, but in the initial stages, we lost all the way up through the Supreme Court. We were denied. And I guess we finished that process around 1991. It was certainly completed. In 1992, I got the idea that why don't we just try to do this trial on television? And so HBO in this country and Thames Television in the UK sponsored a television trial called The Trial of James Earl Ray. We tried the case in 1992. Which was, of course, the 25th anniversary of the assassination of Martin King. The judge was a former federal judge, Marvin Frankel, out of New York. Very tough judge. We fought all the time, particularly in chambers. Eventually, we became friends, but it was very hostile during the trial. The prosecutor was Hickman Ewing, Jr., a former U.S. attorney who had won 200 cases, 200 straight prosecution cases as a U.S. attorney. And some of you may know him and know the name. He was Ken Starr's number two on the Whitewater investigations for a number of months, if not years. Jury came from all over the country. And the rules were very strictly adhered to were the rules, criminal procedure of the state of Tennessee. So it was a serious trial. It had no script or anything. The witnesses were not scripted in any way. It took the jury about 7 hours after that television trial to come back with a verdict of not guilty, James Earl Ray. You probably never heard of that because it was not reported anywhere. And if it was, it was mentioned once or twice in a couple of media entities. It was called entertainment. It wasn't really serious, you see. It's a form of entertainment. But what it did do was to bring to the fore witnesses and information that had not been possible to get before that. So that way was very helpful. And in one instance, we had four witnesses whose testimony would have caused the indictment of a man called Lloyd Jowers, who owned Jim's Grill, which was a cafe at the bottom on the ground floor of the rooming house from which the shot supposedly was fired from the bathroom window. And behind Jim's Grill, there was a big sort of vacant lot, bushy area, heavily overgrown at the time. And it backed onto the Lorraine Motel where Martin King stayed. So these people gave me enough evidence as a result of the trial and them discovering them and the investigation. I had over 22 investigators working for me in the course of that preparation to indict Jowers. Jowers knew about it. I'd known Lloyd Jowers since 1978. He's one of the first people I talked to. So I'd known this guy for 14 years already, and he, of course, never admitted anything, and he lied about everything. But as these witnesses now started to assemble, and it was powerful testimony against him. One of them was his former, and she was still active as his girlfriend and lover at the time, so she became former by 1992. But back in 68, she and Lloyd had a thing going, and she her story was that she came into the grill on the afternoon of April 4th, And she didn't see Lloyd around anywhere. And he was the manager, and he used to show her a cook, and he helped him do everything. And she saw the kitchen door close, which was unusual. So she opened the kitchen door, thinking that, well, maybe he's out in the back fooling around with some of those local ladies, because she never trusted him, really. And as she got into the kitchen, she saw the kitchen door was open, leading to the outside. And as she approached that kitchen, open kitchen door, she heard a gunshot. And she was startled, but she still went on. And as she got to the door, into the doorway, here comes Lloyd running through the bushes, carrying a still-smoking rifle. And he brushes past her quickly, comes inside, bends down to take the shell out and break it down, and says to her plaintively, you know, Betty, you wouldn't do anything to hurt me, would you? And she said, no, Lloyd, of course not. Of course I wouldn't. So he throws the shell down the commode, the toilet back to the kitchen, and stuffed it up. And so in doing it, then covered the rifle with a cloth and brought it out and put it under a shelf. Well, Betty'd known about this, of course, since 1968. And it was only in 1992, I think December 1992, where she finally agreed to tell me this story. And I'd known her for a lot of years. Lloyd tried to keep me from even finding out where she lived. And then there were three others with similar incriminating pieces of information. A taxi driver who saw the murder weapon, whom Lloyd asked to get rid of the murder weapon or hold on to it. There was a whole series of different witnesses. So Lloyd was in trouble, and he knew it. And he said to his lawyer, you go and get me immunity from prosecution, and I'll tell everything I know about this killing. So his lawyer, Lewis Garrison, goes off to meet with the district attorney general and tries to get immunity for Lloyd's. He says, Lloyd will tell you everything. You know, this is the case of the century. You can be the most famous prosecutor in America. You can break this case. Not only does Lloyd not get immunity from prosecution, but the district attorney general never interviewed him, never even spoke to him. So nobody wanted to prosecute Lloyd, but he still was worried. So Lloyd conjures up with his lawyer and some others the idea that he'll try to get this story out publicly. So they contact Sam Donaldson, if you know who he is, but he was an ABC journalist who ran a program called Primetime Live. And Donaldson agreed to have this, put Jowers on and let him tell this story. So Jowers goes on television and tells the story on Primetime Live. And it seems like it's a big news story. I actually got it covered in the Observer in England. I had been living all this time, by the way, in England. Not in the United States. I had moved to England in 1980, 81, and moved my family there. And I was a visiting scholar at Cambridge at the time, and that was a much nicer place to raise children, considering some of the things I was getting myself into. So the next morning, after the Primetime Live program, there was no coverage at all of this. Not even ABC News treated their own program as a newsworthy event. There's no coverage at all and no mention in the press.
My apologies for interrupting the account of the assassination of Martin Luther King at this crucial moment. Please return for the next broadcast of TUC Radio for a report on the involvement of army sharpshooters at the crime scene in front of the Lorraine Motel. You heard the attorney and author, Dr. William Pepper. He became the counsel for James Earl Ray after he became convinced of his innocence. As close friend of the King family, he helped them for 3 decades to lift the veil of silence and deceit that still covers the death of one of the most important leaders of the 20th century. Bill Pepper is the author of An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King. This was part one of a 2-part synopsis of a period in U.S. history that has been obscured, distorted, and suppressed. This was a rebroadcast of my 2003 program, The Execution of Martin Luther King. I recorded William Pepper at Modern Times Books in the San Francisco Mission District. The back windows were open to the Linda Street Playground, and young voices were floating into our silent assembly. 15 years have passed since then, and William Pepper has not given up on this cause. In 2016, his book, The Plot to Kill King, was published by Skyhorse. The book is 700 pages long, and the 400-page appendix represents 26 years of research. The guilty parties remain the same since the publication of an act of state. But the evidence has mounted, with new details of the night of the murder, the trial, and why James Earl Ray was chosen to take the fall. What is left for us to contemplate today is the fact of a government-sanctioned assassination of one of the nation's greatest leaders, and why U.S. military and intelligence organizations had the power to silence King's growing criticism of the war on Vietnam and of his anti-poverty campaign that may be revived in 2018. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
This is the Taylor Report. It is CIET. It's 89.5 FM. And I believe we are joined now by Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes. Hello, Phil.
Stephen, thanks very much for joining us. You and I have talked about this issue of Korea and the crisis over the years. You've written extensively on it at gowans.wordpress.com. And I know you're working on a book about what is at stake here in the terms of relations of particularly the United States and North Korea. But we've had a development, and we're very anxious to get your opinion about this. Many developments, of course, but there's one involving Canada. As I understand, that this very afternoon, the defense minister, Mr. Mattis of the U.S. and Canadian minister, are meeting over dinner, and then tomorrow they're going to go and Tillerson, Secretary of State, and Chrystia Freeland are hosting a meeting of 11 foreign ministers, but 20 representatives altogether of countries. So I guess I'll start with my problem about this. I feel remiss here that we've been describing this meeting in the past couple of weeks since people heard about it as, you know, maybe it could produce something good, and what would be good, and what could Canada's role be. But as we've come within the hours now of the meeting, it sounds like a cabal looking for trouble, because they're talking about imposing, like putting, quotes, teeth in sanctions. For example, interdicting ships around, well, I don't know where they intend to interdict them. And that doesn't strike me as very diplomatic. And Canada's military people are being interviewed today in the Star and Globe saying, we're ready to do what it takes to, you know, if we're called on to stop those ships. What's wrong with this picture? Is this a diplomatic gathering? What the heck is it?
Well, I think the word diplomatic is problematic because, and it's used deceptively. When we talk about diplomatic, people usually think a pacific resolution of some problem. But diplomacy can also mean coercion. And there are two forms of coercion the United States is using, along with its allies, and that's a kind of diplomatic coercion, as they call it, and also a military coercion. And the Vancouver meeting is being presented as a way in which, well, it's presented ambiguously, but the idea here is the Vancouver meeting is a way to pursue diplomacy, but what it is really is a way to coerce North Korea into capitulating to U.S. demands that it denuclearize. And so what they're doing in Vancouver is they're organizing a naval blockade. Mm-hmm. That's what it's about. I mean, they talk about...
And is that a U.N.? I was furious, I have to confess, reading the Globe. They used a strange language. They said, well, there's U.N. sanctions, and then the military man, the general, Canadian general, said, if we're called upon to implement the U.N. sanctions, well, no, the United Nations never asked them this meeting to get a kind of a party of navies together to start stopping ships. In the history of stopping ships, wars come.
Yeah. The UN Security Council has acted way beyond its authority in imposing sanctions, which is the DPRK calls what they've imposed just recently a complete economic blockade, which they've done on completely spurious grounds, on the grounds that North Korea is testing ballistic missiles. There's no international law which prohibits any country from testing ballistic missiles, or on the grounds that it was doing nuclear testing. Well, there's no law that prevents the DPRK from testing nuclear weapons either. It has withdrawn from the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, and the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty allows countries to withdraw if they believe their supreme interest are jeopardized by their continued involvement in the treaty. And North Korea made a very compelling case that indeed its supreme interests are jeopardized. It's jeopardized by U.S. aggression. And so they looked for a means of deterring U.S. aggression by building nuclear weapons. By the way, I mean, if you look at the reasons why the United States and Britain and Russia have nuclear weapons, why? They say to deter aggression. Well, if they can have nuclear weapons to deter aggression, then North Korea can have nuclear weapons to deter aggression. And North Korea has indisputably been the object of and subject of extreme U.S. aggression for 70 years. And that aggression is escalating. But the UN Security Council, I think, has gone way beyond its authorization to impose those sanctions. And now there's a meeting in Vancouver to essentially talk about organizing a naval blockade to enforce the sanctions, to ensure that North Korea is completely strangled.
And I was telling the listeners earlier that this... We're in strange Lovian country here because the Globe and Mail tells us that one of the reasons that the meeting is going forward is to hold at bay the war hawks in Washington. In other words, it's a Tillerson ploy, and they say it's also Tillerson and Mattis. I thought everybody agreed that Mattis was crazy, but it's Tillerson and Mattis putting on a little show in order to hold off the war dogs in Washington. You know, this brings up the issue of what Putin said about the United States. And I know we're not supposed to quote him, but he seems to be the leader of Russia. He said, we don't know who's running that place. Nobody. If they stage something, if we were to believe the Globe, I think they're probably the Globe is the one who's addled on this, but that this is part of an exercise to calm down the preemptive strikers in Washington.
Well, Yeah, I mean, it's part of the same approach. I mean, the United States' goal is to force North Korea to denuclearize. So that's its goal, period. So there are various ways in which you can do that, one of which is a military strike, a military campaign. But that's exceedingly dangerous, and that's not really one they would like to undertake. And then there's what they call diplomacy, which isn't really diplomacy. It's coercing North Korea, imposing your will through doing something other than projecting metal at the enemy. And in this case, it's imposing economic sanctions and then organizing a naval blockade. Well, a naval blockade is a military approach to this solution as well, or to this problem as well. But, you know, there's absolutely no expectation on the U.S. side that anyone's going to sit down and negotiate. There's no negotiation. It's simply the issuing of an ultimatum, which is you denuclearize. They talk about bringing Kim Jong-un to the negotiating table. It wouldn't be a negotiating table. It's at a table at which he would sit and would be told what he has to do.
Well, and by the way, he's perfectly willing to talk to you if you would give him an invitation and treat him as a leader of a country, right?
Right, and the United States has absolutely no intention of doing that. And
someone says, you know that old expression, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu?
Yes, exactly. And we could look at this. Tim Beale, for example, a New Zealand writer, has talked about the United States as the predator and North Korea as the prey. And that's one of the ways in which you can look at this. Certainly the United States is pursuing a predatory policy with respect to North Korea. Mm-hmm. There's not only this issue of naval blockade, but at the same time, there's been all this talk about a military buildup going on in the background. Mm-hmm. Today in the New York Times, there was talk about across the military, officers and troops are quietly preparing for a war against North Korea. And there has been a military buildup. Beginning in February, the Pentagon plans to send more special operations troops to the Korean Peninsula. Mm-hmm. The Pentagon's been regularly flying B-1 bombers over the Korean Peninsula. Yes. Last week, they deployed 3 B-2 bombers from a base in Louisiana to Guam. And later this month, they'll deploy B-52 bombers.
What would they be carrying?
Yeah.
What would be their payload?
The North Korean press has also noted that the Pentagon announced the deployment of 2 aircraft carriers to waters off the Korean Peninsula on January 5th, and the dispatch of another carrier to the West Pacific. And it's expected that these 3 carrier task force groups will be amassed off the Korean Peninsula before the opening of the Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. It's also increased its troop and jet fighter deployments to 7 U.S. Air Force bases in South Korea and Japan. Yes. And then on top of this, they've also talked about the so-called bloody nose strategy. And this is the discussion about a limited military strike against North Korean sites without igniting an all-out war. So in the background...
Yes, they call it... There's a decapitation team, right?
Yeah.
Where I'm supposed to believe that American commandos, doing the way they apparently saw it in the movies, would get to the leader and... Oh, I hate to go on with this, but I mean, they actually, grown men in uniforms, talk about this stuff.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a saber rattling going on in the background. And then we have Tillerson and our own foreign minister talking about this diplomatic approach. But the diplomatic approach is simply, you know, let's coerce them mm-hmm. by a blockade. And if they don't capitulate, well, then we will have to go to war.
Yes.
The Globe and Mail did have an interesting a quote from South Korea's ambassador to Canada, who I think summarized exactly what's going on. He said, you know, previously we thought that there was time to persuade North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons, but this time we have no time anymore because North Korea's at the final point of developing its missile technology. And there's this window of vulnerability for the North Koreans. Mm-hmm. They claim that they finalized their capability, but that's ambiguous, and I don't believe the Americans think they've actually reached that point. Mm-hmm. There's still the question of whether they've developed this reentry, or whether they can, or they developed the reentry technology. But the South Korean ambassador then continued and said, if we fail at this dialogue, it's not a dialogue, it's the mm-hmm. ultimatum, but if we fail, then the remaining option is military strikes. So I think this meeting in Vancouver is really important to evolve into higher level talks for the denuclearization of North Korea. So the objective is denuclearization. If it isn't done through, you know, capitulation because of the blockade, then the plan is a military strike.
Mm-hmm.
But if the North Koreans manage to actually perfect their nuclear weapons capabilities, well, that makes them invulnerable. They can deter
then,
it.
Then they join the club.
Yes.
We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. He has a book forthcoming. Let's hope it gets here before the other thing. I want to go back and ask you this, I mean, to help understand how power works. We're told that there's this meeting that was called, and we get Chrystia Freeland and Tillerson. Well, Canada didn't initiate that meeting, surely. Why don't we just say the U.S. called this meeting?
Yeah, they did.
I mean, isn't it kind of silly to play the game that it was her idea?
Yeah, I know it is silly.
Canadians got to get with it here. They got to be asking a few questions. By the way, we don't have the best Navy. I really wouldn't recommend they go and try to do any of this stuff. They all love to talk, but if they get caught talking, there's going to be a lot of disappointed Canadians, the ones remaining. We need to talk about the power relationships. That's Washington says we're going to get the bullies together. The title was, it's the old gang, the ones who fought Korea. I mean, that's outlandish in itself, right? And then they invite China. When they use rhetoric like that, China said, well, no, we need dialogue and we don't need this kind of meeting.
That's right. And they didn't invite Russia.
For reasons that we're all supposed to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Yet they have a border with Korea, and they also seem to have, undisputably, have missiles and nuclear weapons. They actually have, have not China and Russia both said there's not going to be a war on North Korea? It's not going to end there. Haven't they both said that?
Yeah. And, you know, this ultimately isn't about North Korea. Ultimately, it's about the Pentagon using the Korean Peninsula as the United States' largest power projection platform in the Pacific. That's how the U.S. Army describes its new base in South Korea, the largest power projection platform in the Pacific. It's the power projection platform to project power against Russia.
Why can't these Pentagon people get more press? If they say that, that ought to be on the front page of the Toronto Star so that we all understand we are projecting power.
Right. And, you know, what's North Korea? North Korea is the center of opposition to the Pentagon using their country, which is all of Korea, is the United States' largest projection power projection platform, which is why the United States is so aggressive toward North Korea, because the North Koreans are opposed to that project. The North Koreans want their country back.
Mm-hmm. And that's Korea,
yeah.
the whole shooting match, pardon the expression. Now, your writing has brought to light, of course, that part of the problem is that Korea is the wrong kind of Korea. It doesn't practice business and free enterprise and understand all the foundations of democracy, which is private ownership and command of financial and industrial institutions and all trade, right? North Korea doesn't understand that.
No, it doesn't. So,
doesn't agree, I'm sorry.
The United States is hostile to any country that adopts an alternative approach. I think Obama had an alternative model based on state-owned enterprises, which he called, I don't know. Anyway, he dismissed particularly the North Korean model, against human nature, something of that sort. But certainly, yeah, they're opposed to that. I think there's a greater opposition to the fact, though, that North Korea is opposed to the U.S. presence on the Korean Peninsula. And they've been adamant, they've been consistent that the United States has to leave. And the United States has no intention of leaving.
Yeah. Now, by the way, we spoke to Michael Chosudowski on the station about this matter. He pointed out something interesting, that this past summer there was a vote in the General Assembly at the United Nations. 122 countries, I believe, voted for a resolution calling for a treaty on elimination of nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
And he said no one mentioned, and he had not himself, and we're talking about Michael Chosudowski, had not noticed, North Korea voted for that. Canada boycotted it. They wouldn't even attend the debate. And, of course, the U.S. was opposed to it.
Yes, they were. United States.
North Korea should get some points for being alive and having a brain and such things.
No, they were opposed, and they issued a statement saying the United States, France, and Britain said, we have to have nuclear weapons. How are we going to defend ourselves? But North Korea can't have nuclear weapons because it's not allowed to defend itself.
Yeah, that's a sorry situation. You must have been struck by this, the sports element here. 2 weeks before, 3 weeks ago, I guess it was, I'm just going to throw some numbers, President Trump spoke in genocidal terms. He said, blah, 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 if little Kim, blah, blah, we will bring fire and fury and we'll destroy everything. And by the way, let's point out, the Democrats all applauded his point. They agree with him. They themselves have used such language. And so people sort of braced themselves. And then someone said, oh, there's the Olympics. So talk of annihilating the North Korea has been postponed until the Olympics are over. That's a pretty nice gesture, right?
Yes. And that's exactly what it's all about. And also postponing the war game, these massive war
games. That's right. They called off their big war game until after everybody's had their skiing races and ice skating.
Which is a tacit acknowledgement of just how provocative they are. They didn't want to provoke the North Koreans while the Olympics were going on. They didn't disrupt the Olympics.
So all Americans can relax during the Super Bowl. Nobody's going to start any wars until the game is over and all the ads have been run and been talked about. And then we go back to annihilation and nuclear winter. It suggests that that there's somehow another. They actually seem. I think they think they can run bluffs all their lives, right? I mean, and they just go on with their golf games and whatnot. It's a kind of. I keep coming back. I hate to do it. It's sort of subjective, but that was a strange Dr. Strangelove thesis about the kind of gooniness and madness and egotism involved in these capitals where they have all these weapons. They threaten people all the time. And they sort of act like, but of course nothing's going to happen.
Yes, and they are exceedingly provocative, and I'm not sure we realize just how much they provoke the North Koreans deliberately. There are all kinds of instances, right from, last year, one of the exercises last year involving 350,000 troops. I mean, these aren't small-scale exercises. 350,000 troops is immense. So they do other things like this. They fly B-1 bombers from Guam. They have them fly toward the southern tip of Korea, and then they turn and they head directly toward North Korea, toward the North Korean border. And just before they reach the border, they veer off. That's highly provocative. It turns out they used to do this to the Soviet Union. They used to send phalanxes of B-52 bombers, this is under Reagan, heading to the Soviet border. And just before they crossed into Soviet airspace, they would turn back.
Yes.
Highly dangerous, very provocative. I mean, even talking about this bloody nose strategy, a military strike without igniting an all-out war, this is highly dangerous.
Yeah. That's this. They fall into this thing where they think they have full spectrum dominance and they get to control the board from one end to the other. Unfortunately, there are other people out there who don't always have to oblige them and perhaps one day misunderstand and don't oblige them. Mm-hmm. It would be great if we had a Canadian government actually would say something on behalf of the Canadian people in this situation.
Well, I should mention about Canada. Agreeing. I don't really recognize this, but Canada's involved in all of these war games exercises. You know, we always talk about the U.S.-South Korean war games exercise. They frequently involve Canadian military as well, not only Canada, but all kinds of other countries.
Yeah. Well, this has been Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. Stephen, you're right on the mark. Thank you very, very much. We look forward to your book.
Oh, thank you, Phil.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye. Thank you. And this has been the Taylor Report. I want to remind you, 6:30 at 777 Bathurst, Martin's Day is going to have speaking about Hugo Ex-Tavor and Charles Roach. And you can find us on SoundCloud, Taylor-Report, and Facebook / The Taylor Report. And we hope you'll go there. And you can write to us at The Taylor Report. And so, Francois, thank you very much, and Braden, and we will see you next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.